Blog Talk Radio.
With part two, numbers, psychology, contracts, and law. I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's broadcast, and we will be dealing with the following questions. What is the psychology of law? We're going to start off with that first. How do human resources on your job cheat their employees? What are the laws of power? How do you respond to a write-up on your job? When they write you up, how you respond to that? What is black skin? What is that exactly? We're going to have to get down into that. Why do black women hate the truth? Uh-oh. Okay, I think that's when the fight going to break out. What is the state of the black man's mental health? We got to get down in that. We're going to give you some explanations, and I want you to pay close attention to what we're going to be discussing involving that. Does multiculturalism benefit you the most? Are black men losing interest in black women? Are they? Are white men in love with black women? What evidence do we have? Do we have any proof of that? Well, these questions and many more, we're going to make an attempt to answer all this tonight. But what we're going to do right now is run to our quick commercial, and then we come back. We're going straight down into this law business.
Y'all all right, everybody. Don't forget, the greatest focal point in your life is when preparedness and opportunity meet. Hello. I'm Tahaka Amana L. Bay. I want to give a shout out to all the brothers and sisters across the country that got our secure parting credit information. It was now officially operating in the private. Keep in mind, you can access the direct treasury account, private banking. Knowing the difference between public and private and being able to function correctly, do that OID. Learn about your 1099s. You can do a whole lot of stuff once you have the knowledge to do so. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Fill out the contact us form. Send it to me and I'll send you my free report. TahakaDebtElimination.org.
All right, here we go. All right, we have a document called the UCC Connection. And right here in the introduction, I want you to pay very, very close attention, especially you guys who are dealing with your courts and you're doing up your documents and stuff. And this is what a guy ran into. And it states here that he was asked to testify in a tax case as an expert witness. After many days of preparation, he felt confident of his research. He spent over 30 minutes presenting many Supreme Court decisions that prosecution concluded his statement, and to his amazement, the judge told the jury that they could only consider certain facts, none of which were the facts that he had given. As soon as the trial was over, he went around to the judge's office, and he was just coming in through the back door. He said, "Judge, by what authority do you overturn the standing decisions of the United States Supreme Court?" He sat on the bench a while, and he read the case law. "Now, how do you, a district judge, have authority to overturn decisions of the Supreme Court?" The judge says, "Oh, those were old decisions." He said, "Those are standing decisions. They have never been overturned. I don't care how old they are. You have no right to overturn a standing decision of the United States Supreme Court in a district court." All right? Follow this now. Listen very carefully. Public law versus public policy. The judge said, "Name a decision of the Supreme Court after 1938. Name any decision of the Supreme Court after 1938, and I'll honor it. But all the decisions you read were prior to 1938, and I don't honor those decisions." He asked, "What happened in 1938? He said, "Prior to 1938, the Supreme Court was dealing with public law. Since 1938, the Supreme Court has dealt with public law. The charge that Mr. S. was being tried for is a public policy statute, not public law. And those Supreme Court cases do not apply to public policy." So he asked him what happened in 1938. He said that he had already told him too much. He wasn't going to tell him anymore. Well, he did a little investigation in 1938 and the Erie Railroad. Well, he began to investigate. He found that in 1938 was the year of the Erie Railroad versus Thompson case of the Supreme Court. It was also the year the courts claimed they blended law with equity. He read the Erie Railroad case. A man had sued the Erie Railroad for damages when he was struck by a board sticking out of the boxcar as he walked along beside the track. The district court has decided on the basis of commercial negotiable instruments law that this man was not under any contract with the Erie Railroad, and therefore he had no standing to sue the company. Under the common law, he was damaged. He would have had the right to sue. Follow that? This overturned a standing decision over 100 years. Swift versus Tyson in 1840 was a similar case, and the decision of the Supreme Court was that in any case that of this type, the court would judge the case on the common law of the state where the incident occurred. In this case, Pennsylvania, but in the Erie Railroad case, the Supreme Court ruled that all federal cases would be judged under the negotiable instrument law. There would be no more decisions based on the common law at the federal level. So here we find the blending of law with equity. This was a puzzle to him. As he put these new pieces together, he determined that all our courts since 1938 were merchant law courts and not common law courts. There were still some pieces of the puzzle missing. He said, "A friend in the court. Fortunately, he made a friend of a judge. Now you won't make friends with the judge if you go into a court like a wolf in black country. You must approach him as though you are a sheep and he is the wolf. If you go into court as a wolf, you make demands and tell the judge what the law is, how he had better uphold the law or else. Remember the verse, 'I've seen you out of sheep and wolf country. Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves.' We have to go into court and be wise and harmless and not make demands. We must play a little dumb and ask a lot of questions. Well, I asked a lot of questions and boxed the judge into a corner where they had to give me a victory or admit what they didn't want to admit. He won the case, and on the way out, had to stop by the clerk's office to get some papers. One of the judges stopped and said, 'You're an interesting man, Mr. Freeman. If you ever in town, stop by, and if not sitting on a case, we will visit.' America is bankrupt. Later when I went into to visit the judge, he told him of a problem with the Supreme Court case dealing with public policy rather than public law. He said in 1938, all the higher judges and top attorneys in the U.S. attorneys were called into a secret meeting, and this is what we're told. America's bankrupt nation is owned completely by its creditors. The creditors own the Congress, they own the executive, they own the judiciary, and they own all state government. Take solid judicial notice in this fact, but never reveal it openly. Your code is operating in an amateur jurisdiction. Call it anything you want, but do not call it amateur. Okay? And I'm not going to read all of this. The document is the UCC connection, and that comes along with the fact that we have that over here with us. But we're going to get on down into this thing here now. And what's important to me is that we're going to come back to some more of this law, okay? Don't go away. But I do want to put some emphasis on the mental state of the brothers in this country. We're going to deal with that tonight. And I have some examples I want you to pay attention to. And I want you to really, really think about what we're going to put forward for you and see what you think about that. Okay? We'll get to that. But y'all just hold on a minute. All right. What did the Secretary of State in Michigan say regarding the UCC? The Uniform Commercial Code law governs commercial transactions. The code includes 11 articles covering a variety of areas such as sales, negotiable instruments, bank deposits and collections, and investment securities. Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, titled Secure Transactions, designate the Office of the Secretary of State as the place of filing and searching for secure transaction documents. Now, this is a document called the UCCNU, first edition. And just want to put that out there for you so you can get some of that. Let me go back up here just a little bit. The new act called the District of Columbia Organic Act created the first corporate government that the United States of America has ever seen. And it created a new corporation that most people don't see, let alone believe, because it's corporate America. It has everything to do with commerce. It's under contract law. Shortly thereafter, they created what is known as the Bureau of Vital Statistics. The Bureau of Vital Statistics is what formed a birth certificate, a title, chattel paper, with the help of the 14th Amendment and the newly created Bureau of Vital Statistics. This birth certificate is what created the first ever American corporate person known as a straw man, a juristic person, any kind of fictitious corporation that you can put in your mind. And just think about it as a fiction. A third party front, a dummy. It is not you. It is the word that reflects the certificate of title, chattel property. It is a contract. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. You get a hold of that document as well. We have that in our possession as well. But let's get on down in here. And we're coming back. But let's deal with the mental status of the brother. We'll deal with that first before we get on down and everything else. And we want to look at this from this guy's perspective and see what he has to say before I bring in the other information and put in my two cents word. And then we'll decide from there what you think. Okay? Okay, first, oh, here it is right here. All right, here we go. Hold on.
Death, depression, divorce, debt, devastation, deadbeat, despair. There is a black male mental health struggle. I became a therapist in therapy. The unsustainability of black male trauma, black male rage, Black male resentment is a real thing, an unsustainable thing. So what's the struggle? 1 in 4 psychologists are black. And when I say black, I mean that includes black men and black women. According to the American Psychological Association, 4% psychologists worldwide. Nah, in this country. For every 100,000 black Americans, only 1 black psychiatrist. 7% of black men received any form of mental health services in the last couple years. Black youth, particularly black boys, are introduced with the struggle of mental health at a very early age. It's treated in elementary school by suspension or special education referrals. What's the black struggle? That's it. The inadequacy of practitioners who look like black men, who have a unique experience with mental health. Right? What does that mean for all of us? The current mental health industry does not sustain black male trauma, black male rage, black male resentment, which means we have to look at the factors that are uniquely attributed to black males in this country. What makes me qualified to talk about black male mental health struggle? Well, beyond the obvious of being a black male, I crashed in 2008, the year the mortgage industry crashed, the real estate market, right? That same year, my mother informed me for cancer. In 2009, I became a father for the fourth time. But this time was unique because the child was already 21 years old, which means right before my 17th birthday, I had a child. In 2010, my mother ended up passing away from cancer. I moved her from Chicago to Georgia before the diagnosis to live out her golden year under the sun of the South, to work with me and for me. She ended up passing. In 2011, I went to what I now label as a very eventful divorce. I lost everything. I walked away from everything. I lost my family, my spouse at the time, time away from the children, assets, things of that nature. In 2012, I experienced my very first panic attack. I found myself in the middle of a public park here in Atlanta, lying on my back, crying profusely for what seems like hours. In 2013, I had my second panic attack. This one was different. This one, I was with a partner at the time, and she said that she overheard me saying some things that were troubling. Later on that day, I had a special event I needed to be at. My friend at the time took me to the local emergency room because as black males, that is how we address our mental health struggles, right? When it really gets to a point, you have to see someone at the local hospital emergency room. So, of course, they kept me 72 hours suicide watch. I missed the court date. My partner at the time took the signed medical excuse to court at the time that I was supposed to report. The judge refused it, subsequently generating a bench warrant, and I eventually had to address that. That same year, 2013, my father passed, just when we were attempting to repair a 40-plus year fragmented, fragile, broken relationship. He passed. Went to Chicago, to Des Moines and back to Atlanta 2 days after mourning my dad's death, was pulled over by local law enforcement. I had to settle that warrant from a few months earlier. So for the next 57 days, I sat in a jail cell, in a jumpsuit, grieving what I thought initially was only my father's death, what I now know was all of the stressors, the losses, the trauma, the rage, the resentment I had since I crashed the same year the mortgage and real estate market crashed. So during that time, I went to 5 different therapists. Now, I wasn't shy from therapy because my mother, bless her heart, she was ahead of her time. She took me to see a therapist in high school. We're talking in the 80s. The good thing is it ended up being family therapy, and we learned a lot of tools and strategies that really benefited us. But when it was my time, during 08 to 2013, it felt differently, right? But I still went. I went to 5 different. The first 4, nothing. It was cool to share my struggles, but I didn't get any help. Why? Because it was irrelevant, right? The practitioners who did not look like me were culturally incompetent. They meant well. I didn't have time to teach them about my lived experiences. I needed tools and strategies. I needed them like yesterday. So after going through 4 different therapists, I gave up on therapy. I knew I was in trouble. It was evident in my life. I still didn't know where to go. Good friend urged me to take one more attempt to finding a therapist. So I did.
Okay, we're back, everybody. Now, that is, find that quite interesting. Never been in that position myself. However, I have something I want you to take a look at. I want you to think about this very, very carefully before I bring in this information. Have you ever noticed how nature and the universe is always in sync? We got blackbirds that hang with blackbirds. Redbirds are with redbirds. Crows are with crows. Sparrows, ducks with ducks, horses hang with horses. The tide of the oceans roll in at a certain time, and then they roll out. I mean, they ain't never running late. They always come in and out unless there's some upheaval out in the atmosphere somewhere. The sun rises and sets in the east at a certain time, and it rises and sets in the west at a certain time. It rises and sets on the continent of Africa, South America, you know. But everything is in order and in sync. Everything. We have spring, winter, fall, autumn, summer. Every year, year and out, everything is in order. But now, when it comes to people, with our smart self, we so smart. It is amazing how successful we have become as a result of being so smart. We have educational systems in the country where you go to school, get a good education so you get a good job, and then you go to college. And you could get a career and all of these things. And we think that we got it going on, and all of nature and the universe is wrong and we right. How, I mean, what is it that causes us to be so brilliant. We say Sunday is the day of worship. It's God Day on Sunday. Okay? And on January the 1st is New Year's. That's the beginning of a new year. And December the 25th is Christmas. Now, that's when Jesus was born. Brilliant. Then we have Easter. Now, this is amazing, where we have a rabbit running around with chicken eggs and with paint on them. Amazing, with our smart self. Well, anyway, let's take a look at some things, and this might explain some of the mental illness that some of us might be suffering from. We'll take a look at some of this stuff and see what y'all think. Okay? Yeah, kidding.
This episode of Reason Africa was made possible by our fans on Patreon. If you would like to get early access to these videos, please consider supporting our channel on patreon.com/ReasonAfrica. Time travel has always been a staple of science fiction. The idea of traveling through time is deeply fascinating. You get into a machine, press a few buttons, and step out not just somewhere else, but in a different time. It's really easy to imagine, but can it really be done? Well, yes, it can, in a limited sense. Over 100 years ago, Albert Einstein proved that time is intrinsically elastic, capable of being stretched or shrunk by motion. A perfect illustration is if you take the roughly 8-hour flight from London to New York and back to London, you will leap a split second into the future of stay-at-home Londoners. Whereas scientists are figuring out how to turn back the clock to travel in time, actual travel is limited only by how much cash we can spare, visa requirements, and flight cancellations. Making a voyage to the past is limited by the cold, hard laws of physics. Or maybe it's not. What if I told you that you could actually travel back in time? Not just a mere leap of a second that Einstein proved you could, but a massively unimaginable 7 years and 8 months all the way back to the start of 2014. Where could this be? It would have been fun to get your guesses if you hadn't noticed the title of this video, but that's just not how YouTube works. This is Ethiopia, the only country in the world whose year lasts 13 months instead of 12, and where the nation's calendar is more than 7 years out of sync with the one used in March of the rest of the world. While there are many cultures around the world that have and follow their own calendars, which are not the same as the Gregorian calendar, however, they abide by the rule of 12 months a year, making Ethiopia curiously unique. Unlike the Gregorian calendar used widely in the West, Ethiopia's version not only squeezes 13 months into every year, that is 12 months comprising 30 days each, and an additional month made up of just 5 or 6 days, depending on whether it's a leap year, it is also 7 years behind the Western calendar. Last week on Saturday was September 11th, 2021, for all countries in the world. But on that day, this Horn of Africa nation marked the beginning of its new year, 2014. Traveling to Ethiopia is therefore definitively taking a trip back in time. The additional 13th month of the Ethiopian year, called Pagum, has 5 days and 6 days in a leap year. In contrast, the Gregorian calendar has days that can be less or more than 30 days in a month. some differences were the result of kings adding extra days on the months bearing their names in their honor in the Julian calendar, such as July and August, which were named after Julius Caesar and Augustus and have 31 days each. One of the reasons why Ethiopia celebrates its New Year in September is that the number of daylight hours and nighttime hours happens to be exactly equal across the globe once every September, and the sun and the moon, which are used to count time, each set after 12 hours, also called an equinox. These are the days when the sun is exactly above the equator, which makes day and night of equal length. This means that Ethiopians also tell time differently from most of the world, with the day divided into two 12-hour slots starting from 6. Here, days start at dawn rather than midnight, which would make both midday and midnight 6 o'clock in Ethiopian time. They don't usually use the anti-meridian and post-meridian timing and begin their day at 1 a.m. and end at 12 p.m., which is sunset local time. We can only imagine the explosion of confusion that would ensue if this system was to be adopted across the world, but Ethiopians make it work. That is, until you introduce newbies to the system. The use of a different calendar has always confused foreigners visiting the country. Keeping appointments with locals is more often than not a nightmare for foreign visitors, who are always encouraged to make it clear when they are making appointments with locals on whether they are referring to local or European time. The other reason is derived from religious belief. The Ethiopian calendar is greatly intertwined with biblical anecdotes. The last day of the year in the country, which the rest of us call New Year's Eve, is referred to as Pagume Main, pardon my pronunciation, and the first day of a new year is Enkuntatash, meaning the gift of jewels. The Enkuntatash tradition dates back to the time when the famous Queen of Sheba returned from her journey to visit King Solomon in Jerusalem, where she was gifted expensive jewelry. Her return to Ethiopia after receiving the gift coincided with the New Year celebration in September. But Enkuntatash is not exclusively a religious holiday. Ethiopians believe that the month of September shows different signs that explain the beginning of the new year, such as the time where the blooming of flowers are seen everywhere, the rainy and foggy weather leaves, and the pleasant sunny days begin. The distinctive dating system has its roots in the ancient Ethiopian Orthodox Church, which, like Orthodox churches throughout the world, did not follow Pope Gregory XVIII's decision to abandon the Julian calendar for the Gregorian one in 1582. The Ethiopian and Gregorian calendars both use the birth date of Jesus Christ as a starting point for their calculations. The difference in the two calendars is because alternate calculations are used in determining this date. Pope Gregory XVIII, who created the Gregorian calendar, made some changes to the previously used Julian calendar. Several countries that were under the dominion of the Catholic Church had to accept the Gregorian calendar. At the time, many countries opposed the new system, which ordered them to drop 11 days from the Julian calendar. London residents took to the streets to protest the new calendar, holding banners that demanded, "Give us back our 11 days." The region refused to accept the calendar until 1752. The Soviet Union was also a holdout until 1918, when they accepted the new calendar under the influence of its communist leaders. Greece, on the other hand, refused to switch until 1923. Ethiopia, a country free of any colonial powers and influences of the Roman Church, was not affected by the tides and easily retained its original calendar. which claims that Jesus was born in 7 BC and started counting days from that year on. Other calendars held that Jesus was born in 1 AD. The main departure point is when the Catholic Church amended its calculation. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church did not. According to the Ethiopian calendar, a year has 365 days, 6 hours, 2 minutes and 24 seconds. Once every 4 years, the 6 hours add up to 24 hours and become the 6th day in a leap year. Once in 600 years, the 2 minutes and 24 seconds add up to a full day and form a 7th day. This means that every 600 years, a unique star called Akede in Ethiopian comes out and shadows the sun, causing a total solar eclipse. As recorded by ancient Ethiopian records, Ethiopian elites knew long before modern-day scientists about solar eclipses and predicted when they would take place. So as the rest of the world gears for end-year celebrations in a little over 3 months, Ethiopians have just put down their New Year resolutions for the year ahead. In Addis Ababa, home to around 5 million people, the shopping and new festive mood are winding down as they settle into the new year. The calendar offers foreign travelers the perfect excuse to claim they are 7 years younger than they actually are and to hold two different celebrations for New Year's and Christmas. Most Ethiopians are aware of the Gregorian calendar and some even use both calendars interchangeably. However, hats off to them, they have shown no signs of wanting to abandon their ancient calendar. That's a wrap, guys. A massive thank you to our growing list of patrons. And as always, thank you so much for watching. I'll see you next time.
Okay. All right. Now, we're just getting rolling here now. Because what we're trying to do, I'm trying to show you something here. We are in the West, living in a false sense of time. Everything in nature and everything in the universe is insane. But over here where we at, ooh, ooh. And we wonder why you just can't get a grip on what's going on. If it ain't one thing, it's another. Problem after problem after problem after problem. All right, let's take a look at the calendar before we go down and deal with other evidence. Okay? Hold on a minute.
Ethiopia has proven to be a historical beacon, not only in Africa, but in the entire world, as many historians agree that this is one of the oldest countries in the world. The traditional ties of this country are still strong and unchanged, and as the rest of the world has evolved over the years leaving their ancient history behind, Ethiopia did the opposite, upholding their culture. From the ancient Jez language that dates back to the 4th century and has its own scripts to the calendar, Ethiopia is indeed a unique country. The Ethiopian calendar has been in the spotlight for quite some time, but still, most of the world does not yet know that it uses its own version of the calendar, now known as the Jez or Ethiopic calendar, which is about 7 to 8 years behind. The rest of the world uses the Gregorian calendar, which was introduced in October 1582 by Pope Gregory XIII as a replacement for the Julian calendar. It later spread throughout the Roman Empire and beyond as Christianity spread and influenced the design of almost all calendars elsewhere, as we can see today. As the Europeans were colonizing Africa, they brought forth the calendar which is now widely used all over the continent, but due to Ethiopia's successful resistance to colonization, they were able to preserve their traditional calendar. The Ethiopian calendar has 12 months of 30 days each, with a 13th month that has 5 days, and 6 on a leap year which occurs after every 4 years. The difference of the 7 to 8 years between the Ethiopian and Gregorian calendars results from an alternative calculation in determining the date of the birth of Jesus. According to the Ethiopian calendar, Jesus was born in 7 BC, while the Gregorian one, claims that Jesus was born in 1 AD, thus creating the 7-year and 8-month difference. The Gregorian calendar has been subject to criticism. In 2012, Pope Benedict XVI argued that the Christian calendar was based on miscalculation, and Jesus was born earlier than previously believed, sometime between 7 BC and 2 BC, meaning the Christian calendar based on the year of his birth is off by several years. By the time the Gregorian calendar was introduced, the Julian calendar had already been in use for almost 1,600 years, after which the Gregorian version was implemented to represent modernization and improvement in date-keeping. Julius Caesar, who initiated the Julian calendar, introduced this Egyptian solar calendar, taking the length of the solar year as 365 and a quarter days, which had exaggerated the year with 11 minutes and 14 seconds. Secondly, the excess leap days that were introduced by the Julian calendar had caused the calendar dates of the seasons to regress by almost 1 day per 100 years. As time went by, this error had resulted to massive differences in time, and by the time Pope Gregory XIII was the head of the church in the 1500s, the discrepancy had accumulated to approximately 10 days. To reinstate the correct time, the Pope based his reform on the March equinox, which used to occur on March 11th, but had shifted to March 21st, in 325 C. This change was done on October 1582, when the reform advanced the date by 10 days. If you go back to check your 1582 calendar, you'll notice the missing 10 days, as Thursday 4th October of the year was followed by Friday 15th October of the same year. Currently, the Julian calendar is 13 days behind the Gregorian calendar, but the discrepancy between the two calendars will increase to 14 days in the year 2100. It does not even end there, as Ethiopia celebrates its new year on September 11th, unless it is a leap year, in which case it is celebrated on September 12th, and whose celebrations usually last for a week. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church, which uses the calendar, also recognizes January 7th as the day that Jesus was born, while in most parts of the world, Christmas is celebrated on December 25th. And again, if you are planning on a visit to Ethiopia, the date isn't the only thing you will be cross-checking, but the time as well. Don't wait for me to say they have 25 hours instead of the normal 24, but the way of reading or telling the clock is what is different from the rest of the world, just like the calendar. Similar to the Swahili way of telling the clock, the day starts at dawn and runs till dusk, unlike the rest of the world, where the day runs from midnight to midday. Due to Ethiopia's location near the equator, sunset and sunrise are mostly constant all year round, and are defined as 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. respectively in standard time. This thus means that 7 a.m. is the first hour of the day, and is read as 1 in the morning instead of 7 a.m. An easy adjusting to this time is to subtract 6 hours from the standard clock time. So technically speaking, Ethiopia is not really behind the rest of the world, it is just the type of the calendar they use that brings the difference. This is also the reason Ethiopia will always remain a historical country and a role model to many nations for not abandoning their traditions which have been passed down to many generations for centuries, and by the look of things, this tradition will continue.
Okay, now, the Jesus Christ as a marker, okay, because we've already dealt with that for years and years, and we've already Dr. Walter Williams already gave a breakdown on the Jesus thing. We can get down to that. But anyway, let's deal with something else in regards to this matter. And I want you to think about this now. You just heard what the gentleman said about us having the calendar and stuff. But what we are attempting to do is live our lives and have a normal life out of sync, and with something that's governing time, we out of sync using it, and all kind of stuff is going on. And so let us take a look at something else, and then when we get back, we'll get on down into broadcast. Got one more plug on this thing involving this calendar, because we're dealing with this mental health, and I'm trying to show you this thing from a whole different angle.
This 1775 Bible shows that March is actually the first month of the year, and Sunday, yes, you heard right, is the first day of the week. Take a look.
So this right here is the Bible from 1775 telling us at the time that we used to have 13 months.
The first month of the year is March! Look at all the way to the end, guys. There's 13 months.
13 months. First day of the week, Sunday. Second day, Monday. Look at that. Seventh day or Sabbath, Saturday. This is the proof right here.
I've always been a curious soul, but not in the way you'd expect from scholars or historians. My explorations take place from the comfort of my own home, often late into the night, guided by the soft glow of my laptop screen. This is how I ended up watching a video by Mark Pyers on his channel, Mark Inspires. What I discovered there sent me straight down a rabbit hole. Mark presented an old Bible from 1775, and it wasn't the antiquity of the book that caught my attention, it was the content. According to this Bible, the first month of the year is March, and each week begins on a Sunday. I paused the video. Sunday as the first day? March as the first month? That's not what any calendar I've ever hung on my wall has shown. The curiosity in me sparked. I wondered, if what I was looking at was true, why did everything change? Who decided to flip the script and shift the months around? And why does it feel like we might be out of step with the rhythm that was once so ingrained in our culture that it was worth printing in the good book itself? It was like finding a piece in a puzzle that I didn't know was missing. The more I thought about it, the more questions arose. What if the holidays we celebrate, the ones we've been told were based on ancient traditions, were actually aligned with a different rhythm, one dictated by this forgotten calendar? Take Christmas, for instance, often said to be a rebranding of pagan festivities. If we were following this old system, where would that leave December 25th? Would it hold the same meaning if it didn't coincide with the winter solstice as neatly as it does now? Could this alternative arrangement of time affect not just holidays, but our everyday lives? I'm not an academic with a wall of degrees, but that night, I felt a responsibility to learn more. There was a sense that by understanding the past, by peeling back the layers of changes and adaptations, I might find something essential. Something about how we connect with the universe, with each other, and how we find our place within the cycles that govern our existence. And so, I began a journey. One not through dusty library shelves or ancient ruins, but through the digital realm of information, armed with a newfound determination. I was ready to see where this old Bible's tale would lead me and what it might reveal about the world we think we know so well. Discovering that Sunday might actually be the starting point of the week necessitates a serious reconsideration of cultural and religious norms. It presents the startling idea that the day we traditionally dedicate to rest and religious observance could indeed be Saturday. Such a perspective carries weighty implications for contemporary religious customs, hinting that widespread practices might not align with this historical viewpoint. Astrologically, the impact of such a shift cannot be understated. Each day's energies are traditionally tied to a celestial body, which, according to astrological systems, can influence human affairs. Misalignment between our constructed week and this celestial ordering might disrupt the intended flow of cosmic energies into daily life. For adherents of astrology, this calls into question the very foundation of their practice, suggesting a need for a thorough reassessment of how days and their corresponding planetary energies are observed and honored. This raises the fundamental question, who was it that altered the configuration of our week, thereby altering the fabric of our lives? The catalyst for such a change is not immediately evident. It may have been an incremental process influenced by the shifts in religious and secular authorities over the millennia, or it might have been an intentional move to distance contemporary practice from ancient traditions.
One of the things Constantine did was because he wanted the pagans to worship God, Jehovah, was he moved the day of worship to the day of the sun, which is why we now worship on Sunday. Because Sunday became a pagan day.
One thing is clear. There seems to be a deliberate discrepancy between our current temporal structure and that of historical records, though the motivations behind this are still veiled in mystery. The departure from the calendrical structure as outlined in the 1775 Bible could imply that many facets of our daily existence are misaligned with both historical precedent and perhaps celestial design. This misalignment extends to significant dates of observance, the timing of festivities such as Christmas and Easter, for instance, might not truly reflect their original intent or season. Contemplating a realignment with this historic calendar suggests the possibility of returning to a way of life that is more authentic, perhaps closer to spiritual principles that have been overshadowed over time. It prompts us to consider whether a shift in observance to align with historical records could reconnect us to a spiritual authenticity that has been eroded. This discourse is not merely about adherence to religious rules or speculative astrological theories. It centers on our alignment with the natural and cosmic order that may predate contemporary calendars. Choosing to follow this route is about much more than date correction. It's a quest to uncover a harmony with the natural world that may have been lost. As we delve further into the contents of this ancient text, we have to wonder what further insights they may offer and in what ways these could revolutionize our current understanding of time, spirituality, and our place within the cosmos. This exploration is not only fascinating, but has the potential to be profoundly life-altering. The 1775 Bible, which intriguingly outlines a calendar year starting with March and comprising 13 months, hints at a bygone era's intimate dance with the cosmos. This historical artifact opens a window to explore how our ancestors perceived time and its connection to cosmic energy and planetary alignments. Historically, calendars were not just tools for marking days, they were intricately linked to the movements of celestial bodies. This relationship was seen in the meticulous attention early civilizations paid to the skies. The enigmatic Stonehenge is a prehistoric testament to this, aligned with the solstices, points in the year that mark the sun's most extreme positions in the sky. In the context of the 1775 Bible, the shifted calendar may point to a forgotten alignment with natural cycles. If March marked the new year, it coincided with the vernal equinox, a time of balance when day and night are of equal length, symbolizing renewal and rebirth in many cultures. This could suggest a time when people were more in tune with the rhythms of nature, aligning their lives with the equinoxes and solstices which were critical to agricultural societies. The choice of a 13-month calendar could also reflect a closer alignment with lunar cycles. Traditional lunar calendars, used by cultures like the Hebrews, based their months on the moon's phases, resulting in a year of 12 or 13 months to maintain synchronicity with the solar year. This system is rooted in the observable energy shifts that accompany the transition from one lunar phase to another, which ancient peoples believed influenced agricultural and human cycles. Furthermore, planetary alignments have long been observed and respected. The seven-day week is an enduring legacy of such celestial considerations, with each day corresponding to one of the seven classical planets known to the ancients. The 1775 Bible's depiction of Sunday as the week's first day underscores this connection, resonating with the sun's position of primacy in our solar system. The study of the calendar in the 1775 Bible might reveal more than a mere historical curiosity. It may uncover a lost understanding of time that honored cosmic energy more explicitly than our modern system. It opens questions about how this alignment affected societal behavior, religious observances, and the general worldview of the time. The blending of pagan traditions with Christian holidays is a topic that stirs much debate, especially when we delve into the origins of Christmas. To understand this amalgamation, we need to travel back to the early centuries of Christianity. It wasn't until the 4th century that the church officially proclaimed December 25th as the birth date of Jesus, a date that conveniently coincided with the Roman festival of Saturnalia and the pagan celebration of the winter solstice. These festivals were times of merrymaking, social reversal, and, most importantly, celebrating the return of the sun, Saturnalia for the Romans, and Yule for the Germanic peoples. The church's decision to place Christmas during this festive period may have been strategic, easing the transition for converts by allowing them to continue their traditional celebrations, now under a Christian guise. But the question remains, was Jesus actually born on December 25th? Historical and scriptural evidence suggests otherwise. The Bible does not specify a date for Christ's birth, and some scholars point to clues that indicate a spring birth. shepherds tending to their flocks, which they did during lambing season, a time quite distant from the chill of December. Moreover, the choice of date for Easter, which follows the lunar cycle and the Jewish Passover, reflects a more astronomical and scripturally grounded approach to determining a significant Christian event. Why, then, did Christmas break from this pattern? It seems that the early church fathers were less interested in historical accuracy and more in the symbolism of light overcoming darkness, aligning Christ's birth with the rebirth of the sun.
Well, another thing Constantine did was move the day of Jesus' birth to December, because Tammuz died on December 23rd. And it was believed, because Nimrod, his father, was a hunter, it was believed that Nimrod would be reborn in his son Tammuz. And his son Tammuz's birthday was December 25th. And what you would do on Tammuz's birthday was you would set up a tree. Deuteronomy 16:21. You shall not plant for yourself any tree as a wooden image near the altar which you build for yourself to the Lord your God. It was believed that in order for Tammuz to rise again as his son Nimrod, you'd have to go to the tree, you'd have to cut down a tree from the forest, and you'd have to put balls on it. And the balls were symbolic of testicles. The tree was symbolic of a phallus. Jeremiah chapter 10. Look what it says. Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel, thus saith the Lord. Do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of the heaven, for the Gentiles are dismayed at them, for the customs of the people are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. I hate to bring you bad news.
The calendar delineated in the 1775 Bible, with its unconventional 13-month year beginning in March, invites us to revisit historical timelines and spiritual narratives. Among the most profound is the birth of Jesus, traditionally celebrated in December. However, if the ancient calendar were a more accurate measure, could it be that the nativity story unfolded in the spring? Such a shift is not merely a technical correction of dates. It proposes a re-examination of astrological and spiritual symbolism that has long been intertwined with the season of Jesus' birth. Spring, marked by the vernal equinox, is a time of renewal, when the earth awakens from the dormancy of winter. It's the season when lambs are born, which coincides with the historical account of shepherds watching their flocks by night, a detail supporting a springtime nativity. If Jesus was indeed born in the spring, the association with Aries, the ram, in the zodiac becomes intriguing. Aries, beginning in late March, is a sign often linked to leadership and new beginnings. Such a synchronization would weave Jesus' birth into the tapestry of astrological lore, presenting him as a figure heralding a new epoch, aligning with the symbol of the ram often associated with sacrifice and new initiatives in various mythologies. Exploring further, the spring equinox is a time when day and night are in perfect balance, which might symbolize the dual nature of Jesus as both human and divine. This natural harmony could provide a powerful allegory for the spiritual equilibrium he is said to bring. This repositioning of the nativity to spring could also influence the spiritual interpretation of biblical texts. For example, the light coming into the world gains a literal dimension as the days grow longer and the darkness of winter recedes. The themes of rebirth and resurrection, central to Christian doctrine, naturally align with the world's awakening in spring. Moreover, the implications for Easter, closely tied to the Jewish Passover, are significant. Rather than a wandering date with the Gregorian calendar, a springtime Christmas would closely precede Easter, linking Jesus' birth and resurrection even more tightly within the cycle of natural and spiritual rebirth. The hypothesis of a springtime nativity prompts a reevaluation of our understanding of one of Christianity's most sacred narratives. It invites believers and historians alike to ponder the relationship between celestial cycles and sacred events. Each potential revelation nudges us to consider how celestial events have been foundational in shaping our spiritual traditions and how they might continue to do so if viewed through the lens of a calendar that perhaps once more closely mirrored the cosmos. The Julian calendar, established by Julius Caesar in 45 BCE, was a turning point in the annals of timekeeping. This calendar shifted from a lunar to a solar structure, extending the year from 355 days to the 365-day format we're familiar with, albeit with some inaccuracy. A day's surplus accrued every 128 years. In its wake, it is believed that a 13-month calendar, one that may have been more attuned to natural cycles, was cast aside. The reasons behind this transition were both practical and political. Roman society, growing increasingly complex, demanded a more predictable and uniform system to manage festivals, agricultural cycles, and taxation periods. It was also a power move. Emperors often manipulated the calendar to extend their terms or to insert their own festivities. These changes, subtle at first, would ripple through time to become vast overhauls, with each successive power leaving its mark on how we measure our days. Why then did the 13-month calendar, which might have had a more natural alignment with lunar cycles, fall out of favor? The omission of this 13th month could be a lost connection to a time when the night sky played a more pronounced role in daily life. Historical records are riddled with gaps and inconsistencies, some possibly by accident, others likely by design. The transition from a 13-month to a 12-month year is muddy at best. There's a school of thought that suggests the church and ruling authorities intentionally steered away from lunar calendars to diminish the influence of pagan traditions, which were closely tied to the phases of the moon. The removal of the 13th month could also be tied to numerology. 13 has been viewed with superstition in various cultures. Its exclusion might have been a deliberate effort to avoid association with a number so often linked with bad luck, or with women's menstrual cycles, which were often viewed with fear or disdain. If indeed there was a 13-month calendar that reflected a more accurate cosmic rhythm, what were the implications of its abandonment? Our modern calendar is misaligned with the lunar cycle by nearly a day each month. Over time, this dissonance could lead to a societal disconnection from natural patterns, affecting agriculture, mental health, and spirituality. Religious festivals, many of which were once synchronized with celestial events, now float through the year, untethered from the rhythms they once celebrated. Christmas, Easter, and other holidays have been assigned fixed or fluctuating dates that may no longer correspond with the times of year they were originally meant to honor. The ripple effects of a calendar out of sync with the cosmos may be more profound than we realize. Agricultural practices that were once timed to the reliable rhythms of the moon now rely on the imperfect Gregorian calendar. This subtle shift may have gradually distorted our connection to the environment, leading to practices that are less sustainable and harmonious with the Earth's cycles. In spiritual terms, the impact is even more esoteric. If sacred days are misdated, the collective energy focused on these times might be akin to misdialed calls in the cosmic sense. Are prayers and celebrations reaching their intended spiritual heights, or are they somewhat off the mark? This isn't to question the faith or devotion of practitioners, but rather to ponder the power of collective consciousness and its relationship to the timing of sacred observances.
Okay. There you have it. What you think about that? I was thinking the same thing. You interfere with time. You interfere with the natural order of man. He can't help but have a problem. And if it's never corrected, he's going to continue to have the same problem. And if he continues to look for something different to happen while he's still doing the same wrong thing, that's called insanity. And that is exactly what we are experiencing today in this society. I mean, this thing is way out of whack. But for the most part, a lot of people don't want to turn around. We got churches that they probably shoot me for even trying to introduce this because he's messing with the money. You know, Sunday, you talking about messing with Sunday. We have first Sunday. Well, that's incorrect. Sunday is the first work day of the week. Just like you go to work on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. You begin your day in the west when the sun go down. That is the beginning. If the sun go down on Sunday, now it is officially Monday. But to try to get folks to understand that, now you're talking about flight. So if you are begin to understand this and you start actually using this, you'll feel better. You're in alignment with nature, your energies, your spiritualism, all that'll be fine. You'll benefit. But you are going to run into a tremendous amount of turbulence when it comes to family members and friends and acquaintances out there in the street who will probably not only verbally attack you, but want to physically harm you, because anytime you have darkness and you bring a light, darkness flees. Go in a dark room and strike a match, the darkness runs. Go. Cut on a light in a dollar. Boom, where the dog went. It just dipped. But anyway, I wanted to bring that in. That will give you something to think about in regards to our position here on this planet. Now, before I go back down into another vital piece of this law stuff, I'm going to run another commercial and take a little quick, very, very short musical break, and then we'll be ready.
Once again, don't wait until it's too late. Hi, I'm Tahaka. Get out of debt now. Use what you already have at your disposal. Try living in the private for the first time in your life. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. What are you going to do when the economy collapses? What are you going to do when life in the public becomes so unbearable you don't think you can survive? There is something you can do now. Gain the benefit now of using the private banking and credit available to you. Avoid the loss of your hard-earned cash, which are debt notes. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Request my free report by filling out the Contact Us form, and I will rush the report to your email box. Act now. We still have a small amount of time. TahakaDebtElimination.org.
Okay, we back. Yeah, hold on 1 second. We'll take another quick break. Get your glass of water, what have you. And just then drink you a little, couple of swallows and get on back with us. everybody now. I'm going to get on back down into this last little piece of law here. And keep in mind that the documents that I'm going over a little bit with you comes along with our packages, just a fraction, a little smidget of what we offer to the people who get our secure party and creditor package. And what we want you to do once we convert this over into a YouTube video, go ahead and subscribe to our channel. Give us a thumbs up or a thumb down, either way you see it. If there's anything in there you agree with or disagree with, go ahead on and send us a comment, and we'll get back with you on that. Private registered bonded promissory note. It's on bonded paper and stuff. It's a negotiable instrument. This one is set up for $55 million. The note number is there. The USPO registered number is there. Paid to the order of John Henry Doe, $55 million United States dollars. John Henry Doe, for John Henry Doe, the count is there. And it states here on this particular instrument, it says this negotiable instrument tendered lawfully by John Henry Doe, maker in good faith, shall evidence as a debt to the payee pursuant to the following terms. This is an unconditional promise to pay. This note shall be posted in full dollar for dollar pursuant to the credit audit noted above and presented to the payer, the United States Department of Treasury, care of trustee of the United States bankruptcy, and the person in charge there. After discharge of the debt, the balance of the funds is to be credited to John Henry Doe to be used for the benefit of the same. Payer shall, upon receipt of this instrument, charge account 1234567 89 via pass through private prepaid treasury account 1234567 89 for the purpose of terminating any past, present, or future liabilities expressed or implied, attached or attributed to 1234567 89. This is a public debt obligation of the United States. Payer shall ledger this note for a period of 6 months commencing the start of the business of March 17, 2010 until close of business September 13, 2010, not to exceed 180 days at an interest rate equal to the current rate per annum. Upon maturity of this note, shall be due and payable in full with interest and any associated fees. Payment shall be ledgered against private registered offset or discharge bond number, such a number. USPO registered mail tracking numbers, they are held and secured by the person in charge of the Treasury of the United States on board where prohibited by law. And it goes down into the all caps and then the man on the right and the date of issue and the signature. It's on bonded paper. This is very, very well done. But anyway, I just want to make you aware of what's available to you once you get our secure party creditor package. And we'll explain the stuff to you once you get this stuff and start operating in the private. Okay, but right now, for those of you who are on the job, how does the Human Resource Department cheat its employees? Let's take a look.
Okay. In this video, I'm going to expose four nasty tricks that Human Resources uses to cheat their employees out of money, rights, and their jobs. If you're not aware of these, it's only a matter of time before you fall for one. My name is Brannigan, and I'm an employment lawyer. Oh, and these tricks get worse as we go on, so keep watching. Trick number one is the mighty open door policy. If you open up your employee handbook, there's a 90% chance that somewhere in there, it says that Human Resources has an open door policy. Regardless of the language used, most people understand that to mean HR is there. They want to hear your concerns and complaints. And if you go to HR, they will keep your complaint confidential and you'll be protected from retaliation. This is absolutely not true. They almost never keep your complaint confidential. I've talked to hundreds of employees who went to HR in confidence only to find out shortly thereafter that their complaint was shared with the very person that they were complaining about. But it gets much worse than that. Most companies actually use the open door policy as an early warning system so they can get a heads up on the complaints and quash employee dissent and complaints before they spread. I've talked to hundreds of employees who have complained about something legitimate, and shortly thereafter, they got written up. And shortly after that, they were fired for some sort of vague and nebulous reason. And as a part of this, HR routinely tells people that if you utilize the open door policy, you will be legally protected from retaliation. But that's untrue. Legally, you are only protected from retaliation if you've made a complaint protected by law. And I've made several videos about this subject, and I'll provide links at the end if you want to know more about that. But most HR people know that you're not protected. And if it suits their objectives, they will tattle to management, and you'll get fired soon thereafter. Now, don't get me wrong. There are absolutely times when you should go to human resources and complain in writing. And I go much deeper into that in my video series on how to complain to HR correctly. And I'll provide links at the end of this so that you can watch that. But you should not complain until you fully know why you're doing it, how to do it right, and how to minimize the risks. While the open door policy is a nasty trick, it doesn't even come close to the worst on this list. So stay with me. Trick number two, workplace investigations. Let's say you go to HR to verbally complain about a coworker who's been harassing you and other female employees. The HR rep will listen attentively and take notes. You tell her about what happened to you, and you give her the names of other victims at work. The HR rep then says that she is going to launch an investigation into the matter. This, unfortunately, is a lie. There are no due process rights within a company. Yes, she is going to launch an investigation, but not to find out what actually happened. Her investigation is going to be about how she can best protect the company. You see, human resources is not your friend. The company pays her paycheck. Her job is to protect the company from employees like you. And if a potential lawsuit is brewing, her job is to document the things that help the company, not you. So she will likely destroy her notes that she took during your meeting. She will only interview the witnesses that help the company, not the ones that corroborate your story. Every time she communicates with you going forward, it'll probably be either in person or on the phone, not in writing. She will start working with your direct supervisor to document your performance deficiencies so she can write you up in a few minutes to paper your personnel file so that down the road, if you sue the company can say, look, we wrote her up several times. She was a bad employee. And the worst part of all of this is that when she finishes her investigation, I guarantee she will create some kind of investigation report that concludes there was no evidence of any wrongdoing. Even if the HR rep genuinely believes that you were harassed, she will never put it in writing because her job is to protect the company, not you. Now, with all that said, if an investigation is going on at your job, should you refuse to participate or let this knowledge prevent you from submitting a legitimate complaint to HR? No, absolutely not. You must play the game and participate. If you don't, down the road in litigation, the jury will think that you were the problem, not the company. You must always think to yourself, how would a jury view my actions here? Asking yourself this question is key to doing the right thing in most employment situations. If you're getting value out of this video, click the subscribe button down below. I make lots of videos about employee rights, so if you want to stay in the loop, click the button. Trick number three, they lie. All right, well, in most interactions with HR, there's no reason for them to lie to you. However, there is no legal requirement that they be truthful with you. So when things start to get tough, when there is a dispute, you can count on them protecting their paycheck at your expense. So in addition to what we've already talked about here today, what are the common situations when HR is going to lie to employees? Well, they routinely lie in write-ups and performance improvement plans. They can say that you were late all the time for work when you weren't. They can say that you were insubordinate when you weren't. They can say that you had a bad attitude when you didn't. And if the cumulative effect of all these small lies ultimately leads to your termination, they know that they can get away with it because the law of defamation doesn't have much teeth in employment law. I made a video about defamation if you want to know. I'll link below. They also routinely lie during lawsuits. This is super common. I've questioned a lot of HR reps under oath during depositions. They will say that they gave you several verbal warnings when they didn't, or they will deny that other people have complained about the issue that you've complained about. Why do they do this? Well, they do it to protect their job. Think about it. If they tell the truth, they're probably going to cost their company a whole bunch of money. So they lie so they don't get fired. The only way to hold them accountable is to have a really good lawyer who can impeach them properly during the case. But this trick, this lying, still isn't even close to the worst trick on this list. The next one is the worst. It has screwed millions of Americans out of billions of dollars, and I'm not exaggerating. Before we get to it, I should say one last important thing. I have a license to practice law in California. A lot of people who see my videos want to contact me, and that's great, but the free consultation process at my office is for California workers who got fired from their job, and they believe that they have a case for harassment, retaliation, discrimination, or wrongful termination. If that applies to you and you think I've earned your phone call, don't be afraid to give me a call for a free consultation. Trick number four, and this is the worst, arbitration. My office gets literally thousands of calls each year. And just about every single one of those people, we ask the following question. Did you sign an arbitration agreement when you started work at the company? Most people respond by saying, what's arbitration? And therein lies part of the insidious deception of this trick. Very few people even know what arbitration is and what its implications are for workers. But don't worry, I will explain. Here is how it works. After you accept the job offer, HR says, congratulations, and then they slide over a bunch of documents for you to sign. Happy to have a new job, most people quickly sign them without ever reading them. And somewhere between 20 to 40% of employers have their new employees sign in an agreement called arbitration. Or the arbitration agreement is buried in the employee handbook and the employee signs an acknowledgement page that says they agree to the terms in the employee handbook. Now, if you try to refuse the arbitration agreement, say you refuse to sign it, HR will probably rescind the job offer. Okay, well, what does arbitration actually say? Well, an arbitration agreement says that if there's ever a dispute between you and the company, you can't sue them in the public court system. You have to sue them through private arbitration. And if valid, that agreement forces you to fight for your rights in a secretive, binding judicial process where if you lose, you have no right to appeal. So you can't sue in the public court system. How it works is if you file for arbitration, an arbitrator, which is usually a retired judge or a former defense attorney, becomes the judge and jury for the case. This arbitrator is paid hundreds of dollars an hour by the company to act as a neutral adjudicator. And if you have any common sense at all, you're asking yourself, if the arbitrator is getting paid thousands upon thousands of dollars by the company that you're suing, how often do they actually rule in the employee's favor? Well, the answer is not nearly as often as they rule in favor of the company. So let's say you have a great case against the company. When your case is forced into arbitration, its settlement value becomes substantially less than if it were in the regular court system. That's great for the company and terrible for you. And I've talked to dozens of my employment lawyer colleagues, and they all say that arbitration dramatically reduces the value of the case. And if you extrapolate this out on a nationwide basis, billions and billions of dollars of employee money is lost. But that is not even the worst part. Yes, you can sue them in arbitration, and you might get something. Sometimes you get something that's pretty much okay. but most arbitration agreements say that you cannot sue them on a class-wide basis. That means you can't bring a class action against the company. Why does that matter? Well, let's say the company has failed to pay you $5,000 in unpaid overtime. $5,000 is a lot of money, but that is not nearly enough to justify hiring a lawyer and pursuing a case against the company. The costs of that case will quickly overwhelm the value of it. Those smaller claims are just not worth pursuing, even on a contingency basis. But if you and your lawyer can gather together 100 plus people and sue on a class-wide basis, then the case becomes economically viable to pursue. So if you're paying attention, what this means is if there's an arbitration agreement, those smaller claims just don't get pursued, period. Ergo, the company gets away with theft. By my estimate, and many other lawyers I've talked to, without question, tens of billions of dollars of employee money across America is lost each year because of arbitration. Without question, arbitration is the worst trick that HR and employers use to steal employee wages and minimize the size of harassment, retaliation, and wrongful termination claims. Well, okay, Brannigan, how can you avoid this? Well, that's a big subject in and of itself, and I don't have time, unfortunately, to cover it today. But if you want me to make a video on arbitration, let me know in the comment section down below. Believe it or not, this is my third video on human resources. And if you've watched the...
Okay, there you have it. I hope y'all got some out of that. And I would encourage you to listen to this show over and over and over so that you, when you go to work, you know what's going on and you can prepare yourself and deal with them. Me personally, I don't work for companies anymore, and they would sure have a pickle on their hands if I was. However, let's go on to the next thing. How to respond to a writer. When they, you know, the companies you work for, where you did this, that, and that, we're going to write you up. How to respond to that. Let's roll.
If you've ever been written up on the job, you know that the write-up is a sign that things are not going well. While some write-ups are legitimate and are sincerely meant to help you improve, others are completely bogus and simply created to justify firing you. So from a legal perspective, how should you respond to a written warning at work? Is there a right way? Is there a wrong way? The answer is yes. And this video will give you 12 recommendations on how to respond to a write-up. My name is Brannigan Robertson, and I'm an employment attorney. The 12 recommendations that I'm going to make in this video will help you respond to a write-up so that you can, number one, minimize the risk of being fired, and number two, legally protect yourself in case the company fires you in the future. But before we can get into any of that, we need to get three very important things out of the way. Number one, the amazing thing about YouTube is that we get to learn from each other. If you've been written up in the past, put your story in the comment section down below and describe what happened and tell us how it turned out. That way, we can learn from your experience. Number two, the end of this video is the most important part. That's where I'm going to give the 12 recommendations that I have up on the whiteboard. But don't skip ahead to that. You need to watch the introductory parts of this video in order to understand why I'm making the recommendations that I'm making. Number three, I practice employment law in California. That's where I have my license to practice law. But this video isn't just for people in California. It's for everyone across America because most of the information that I share is not dependent on any particular law. However, this video is not legal advice for your situation. If you need legal advice, you need to call an employment lawyer in your state. However, and with that said, a write-up generally is not a serious enough situation to warrant calling an attorney. I personally don't give consultations to people who are just trying to get free advice on how to respond to a write-up. I would get 10,000 more calls a year than we already get. My office gives consultations to people who have been fired and the circumstances surrounding their termination seems unlawful. So if that's happened to you, feel free, and if you're in California, to call my office. Now, before you can properly respond to a write-up, you need to understand, number one, why managers give them out in the first place, and number two, what rules or laws, if any, do managers need to comply with when they write you up? Okay, let's start to get into it. Broadly speaking, I see three types of write-ups. Number one, type one, your manager genuinely wants to correct what he or she sees as problematic behavior. The write-up is meant to clearly identify what you did wrong so that you're aware of the problem and can take steps to fix it. Type two is your manager doesn't really want to fire you at the moment, but he or she wants to create a paper trail in case your performance issues get worse. Your manager may think that you're an aggressive or litigious person, and this is his or her way of protecting himself or herself and the company. Number three, your manager has already decided to fire you and is simply building a case to justify it. Well, okay, what rules, if any, do managers need to comply with when they write you up? Short answer is there are almost no rules or regulations or laws that managers and companies need to comply with in the write-up process. A lot of people hear the term due process. Due process is the legal term kind of for fairness. And due process or fairness is not required. They don't have to follow a fair process. They don't have to do an investigation. They don't even have to be truthful when they write you up. With that said, when a company disciplines an employee the wrong way, they can get in a lot of trouble in the courtroom. And that brings us to the jury first perspective. And here is where you really need to start paying attention. When lawyers like me get involved in an employment matter, we look at everything through the lens of, what would a jury think about this? A jury is usually 12 random people from your community. They don't care about you. They don't care about the company. They don't even want to be sitting in that jury box. But they are usually the final decision maker and in employment matters that go to trial. Employment lawyers think that this jury-first perspective is key because it provides us with a more objective way to evaluate your behavior that precipitated the reprimand, the manager's write-up, and how you responded to it. And this is how you need to look at your situation. Did you do something wrong at work where a write-up is an appropriate response by the company? Would a jury think that the write-up is fair and appropriate? If so, your response should be dramatically different than if the inverse situation were the case, where you didn't do anything wrong and the write-up is completely ridiculous. On the one hand, a jury is not going to like it if you're hyper-aggressive. The jury is not going to like it if you threaten the company with legal action. The jury is not going to like it if it seems you're trying to manufacture yourself a lawsuit. On the other hand, the jury will like it if you seem like the reasonable person in the situation. The jury will like it if you take responsibility for genuine mistakes. The jury will like it if you make sincere efforts to improve, even if the write-up is bogus. So with this jury-first perspective in mind, we can move on to the 12 recommendations. When your manager pulls you into the office and starts to give you a write-up, here are my recommendations on how to respond. Number one, you need to remain calm. I know this is easier said than done, especially when you believe that the write-up is completely ridiculous, but this is really important. You need to avoid crying or raising your voice or showing extreme distress. Number two, you need to listen carefully and buy some time. Don't react right away. Be calm. You need to listen carefully and ask them to repeat to give you a few extra seconds so that you can think. You should repeat the feedback back to them to ensure that you completely understand what they are saying. Do this without any hint of sarcasm or defiance. And then you should ask them if you can take a day or two so that you can respond as productively as possible. Number three, you should ask questions and take notes. Ask lots of genuine questions without being passive-aggressive or sarcastic. That's not going to help. So when did you allegedly mess up? Who saw you make this mistake? What exactly are they accusing you of? If it's a vague accusation, ask for specific examples. And then you should also take notes. You'd be surprised at how much you'll forget after the fact if you don't take notes. If you can't take notes in the moment or you forgot a pad and paper, then right after the meeting, take some time and write everything down that you can remember. Number four, do not leap to your own defense and say that others do the same thing and they're not getting written up. While it does matter, especially in a lawsuit, if other employees are doing the same bad thing that you did but are not getting written up for it, it looks terrible and childish if you immediately say this when they present you with a write-up. It is far more appropriate to politely point this out in your written response later, which we'll talk about in a minute. Number five, do not make excuses. There will be a time for that in your written response, but don't do it right then and there when they tell you about their write-up. And six, do not offer to quit. That is a really bad option for many legal reasons beyond the scope of this video. Along the same lines, don't offer to quit in exchange for severance. That is just as bad or, you know, even worse. Unfortunately, I don't have time to explain why in this video. Just know that threatening to quit or asking for severance is a terrible idea. Number seven, if they ask you for a response right then and there, ask for some time, like a day or two, so that you can have some time to think and reflect before responding. Number eight, if they ask you to sign some documents, find out what those documents are before you sign anything. If they're simply asking you to sign an acknowledgement that you received the write-up, then that generally isn't much of a problem. I generally tell people to write at the bottom of the write-up if they're asking for a signature right then and there, I acknowledge that I received this document, and then sign it. On the other hand, if they're asking you to sign the write-up saying that you agree with it and their criticisms, then either don't sign it or write in, I do not agree with some of the comments here, but I acknowledge that I received this document, and then you can sign it. This approach is a lot better than simply refusing to sign the write-up, because refusing to sign it might be seen as insubordinate. And when employees are insubordinate, it often expedites their termination from the company. Okay, number nine, respond in writing. A written response is very important. If the company is targeting you because of some protected characteristic or protected activity that you've engaged in, it's very important that you complain about it in writing. If the company fires you after you've complained in writing, it's going to strengthen your case to have a written record of the thing that you complained about. That'll help a retaliation or wrongful termination case. So what should you say in your response, your written response? You want to focus on facts, not feelings. This is not the time to whine about your boss or air unrelated grievances. You should be specific about what is true and what is untrue in the write-up. If you have proof, attach it. If you have witnesses, list them. Just know that most of your coworkers will lie in order to save their job, no matter how much you think they're your friends. They have families and responsibilities too, and it's very difficult for them to go against the company. Your response should be relatively concise, 2 to 5 paragraphs max, in my opinion. Your response should be polite and professional, and for the love of Pete, please proofread it. Affirm your loyalty to the company as well. But protect yourself by documenting the circumstances in which you received the written warning. You should also review company policies on the subject before you start writing your response. If you didn't violate any company policies, then point it out. And if you feel like you're being targeted for an unlawful reason, such as your gender, race, disability, religion, or something like that, or that you're being targeted because you complained about something that's protected in the workplace, like workplace safety or patient safety, or you didn't want to violate some sort of law, then you absolutely should put that in your written response. Moreover, I think you should also watch my in-depth video on how to complain at work but not get retaliated against, as that video covers the right and wrong way to complain at work. I'll provide a link at the end of this video on how to do that. Number 10, it's really important not to talk to your coworkers about your write-up. This puts them in a very difficult position, and it's not going to help you at all. Number 11, very important, fix the bloody problem. If the write-up is asking you to make more sales calls, then make more sales calls. If it's asking you to stop gossiping at the water cooler, then don't go anywhere near the water cooler. If your boss asks you to stop being insubordinate, then stop being insubordinate. On the other hand, a lot of write-ups that we see are very vague and difficult to comply with, if not impossible. That's why I also recommend that people follow up with their boss proactively, and preferably in writing. Boss, how am I doing? Do you see some improvement from 2 weeks ago when you gave me the write-up? If not, how can I improve? If your boss responds favorably, then great. If he or she ignores your email, on the other hand, that might be a sign that they've already decided to fire you, or the boss is simply not willing to help you get better. Maybe they're even building a case to fire you. If that's the case, your time at the company might be coming to an end relatively quickly. Number 12, start looking for a new job. A warning doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be fired, but obviously it makes it more likely. You might as well start looking for a new job rather than wait. If things start to improve at work, then great, you can punt the job search. But it's really good to be proactive and get a head start on looking for a new job if you're starting to get signs that your time at the company is limited. I hope you found these 12 recommendations to be helpful. If most people responded to write-ups in this way, it would dramatically reduce the chance that they'll be fired. And in situations where the manager is breaking the law by disciplining someone because of a protected characteristic or because of a protected activity, this type of response will be very helpful in their lawsuit. Now, if you found this video interesting, you may also want to watch my video on how to complain at work without getting retaliated against. A link will pop up.
Okay, we're back. I hope this has been helpful to you. And in my opinion, I think this guy did a fantastic job at explaining this. I didn't use none of this on the job when I was working there. They'd write me up. I didn't do none of that. I was just, But anyway, in today's society, I think these tools would be pretty good, you know, work. Very good. I think he did a wonderful job explaining this to you. Now, does the sisters hate to hear the truth? And are the brothers losing interest in the sisters? And are white men in love with the sisters? And what is your opinion about interracial dating? Let's try to go down on the internet, and we're going to start with the sisters hating to hear.
If you want to piss a black woman off, just tell her the truth. I promise you, she'll get mad. And that might sound crazy. Who would get mad at the truth? How can you argue with the truth? Black women, it is our kryptonite. It is like diarrhea to the mouth.
Mm.
It's like diarrhea to the soul. We have this disdain thing when it comes to the truth. We can't handle the truth. We don't tell the truth.
Who is this black queen with her natural hair, curled, no makeup on, looking phenomenal, and reading y'all the Riot Act? Who is she? I'm definitely going to link back to her profile back in the description, so y'all can look forward to that. And if you want to show her some love, I'll always give love to the content creators. And then make sure y'all tap into the Patreon. We did Stock Club today, and that was absolutely lit. So that is a lot of content and a lot of context. So if you're looking to get to the bag or you're looking to align yourself with a group of people that's going in the direction that you're going in, that is available for you. And then Teach Henley, 40% off your first order plus 20% off for life. Who is this queen? Well, you know we're going to spin a block and we got to start over because for us C students over here, I know a lot of y'all are smarter than me, but for us C students over here, we got to make sure that we get the full context in its entirety so that we can hold these women accountable for the things that they're doing, including who they voting for, who they sleeping with, who's going to be a single baby mama tomorrow, who's pregnant, who breaking up their family, the whole nine yards. And she is absolutely positively on point. But let me spin a block real quick, start over, and then we're going to get the full context, and then I'm going to give you my thoughts as a result of it. And thank you guys for sending me this video.
You want to piss a black woman off, just tell her the truth.
Why do they get mad? I don't understand.
And that might sound crazy. Who would get mad at the truth? How can you argue with the truth? Black women.
Mm.
It is our kryptonite. It is like diarrhea to the mouth.
Talk to them.
It's like diarrhea to the soul. We have this disdain thing when it comes to the truth. We can't handle the truth.
Y'all know I like them chocolate too, right?
Truth. We don't tell the truth. We don't want to hold each other accountable. We don't want to hold ourselves accountable. Anything that involves having to face reality, face what really is, we don't like it.
She got a wedding ring on? I like it, but I don't like that. You know what I'm saying? Because I be possessive sometimes when I see them like this.
And black women who struggle with that, they will, again, when they don't like the truth, when they can't handle the truth, they will try to tell you the truth is not the truth. The sky is not blue when we
Facts.
Know it's blue.
Facts.
You know what I'm saying? You could look up a stat and show the stat, and they'll still argue and say, well, maybe it's right there. And that's my problem when women are like, show me the stats. You can show the stats. You can say the stats, and people will still argue with the stat because they don't want to face the reality of this is what it is.
Mm.
Black women, we are at the bottom when it comes to marital rates, single-parent homes, obesity rates. Like, those things are facts. But some way, somehow, we will still argue with the fact instead of just doing the work to change all of that. But, again, the need to be right, the insults, the shaming, all of those things to make us, to try to make yourself feel better, is damaging.
What more can I say? But I will say more because I want to add additional context, and she's absolutely right. The alternative is what they opt for. And so instead of doing the work, because, you know, instead of saying, you know what, I am at the bottom, and when I'm speaking to the majority, I'm speaking to the group, right? Even when I talk about black culture in itself, as a whole, even though I may individually maybe doing my part, taking care of my business on top of things, doing things legally, never been to jail, taking care of family, putting resources into the community, staying in my city instead of moving over into a bigger city and all of this stuff, as a whole, because we speak to the majority and not the minority, and not to just individual situations, even though we may use our own situations in order to illustrate a point. The fact of the matter is the culture in its entirety, which is one of the reasons why we try to influence people to do a certain thing, is trash. And what she's saying, and you got to get out of your feelings so that you can start getting to the results. If you compare yourself or you compare the culture to other cultures or to other success rates when it comes to marriage, when it comes to finances, when it comes to being on top of things, single baby mamas, you have to start taking accountability, and we can't just keep running from the truth just because you're looking for somebody to feel good about it. And so what they usually do is they'll run to a group of women, and let's say it's a whole bunch of women that is single baby mamas. So instead of taking accountability, they start to look for validation. And that is one of the biggest problems. They look for validation. And the problem with validation is that validation does not then get you what you want. And that's what we really start having a conversation about. But at the end of the day, what do you want out of this thing? Do you want success when it comes to finances? Do you want your family to be intact? Do you want to have great relationships? Do you want to be married? What do you want? Do you want to be taken care of? Do you want to be able to live in your femininity? Because I can't imagine, like, you can't convince me or pay me to believe that you want to be out here grinding, hustling, beating yourself up, not getting to the bag, not getting results, not having people or having your pick of the litter, having your family broke up, being a single baby mama, and then having to go out here and compete for resources against people like me. And then that's what you then exhibit in every single thing that you have in your life. It is reflected in your voting patterns. It's reflected in the people that you follow on your social media and what comes up in your feed. All you see, I don't even follow any of these popular sites. I don't follow the World Stars and the I don't follow none of these platforms, right? If they follow me and they're using my content, there's nothing I can do about that. But that stuff don't pop up in my algorithm. The only reason I even have videos to react to is because y'all send them to me, and so that then familiarizes me with the mindset of people in general, or the ones that's spewing a lot of this nonsense in the society. And so then we address it accordingly, because we have to get to the brass tacks of things. And ultimately, I want to leave this earth in a better space had I not been here, so I don't have to go through it in order to provide you a solution. Sometimes I can use myself or use other people as an example in order to illustrate a point that I'm trying to convey to the general public. And so accountability should not be your kryptonite. Accountability should not be your kryptonite. You should not be running from the truth. The truth is the thing that set me free. And I'm talking about it so many different facets in my life. You know, I remember when I was younger and I had got laid off, or not even got laid off. I just lost my job flat out. Let's just keep it real. I lost my job. I was working at the steel mill, and everything, it just seems like, was going wrong in my life. And it was easy for me to just blame society or blame the system or blame the economy at the time, because it was the 2008 crisis and all of that stuff. And I had a conversation with my brother. It was my younger brother, who was 6 years younger than me. And I was, 26 at the time? And he had to be 20. And the reason that I'm trying to convey that is because I'm not sure what time of the year it was. So I'm not sure if he was 19 or 20. But the fact of the matter is that he just read me the Riot Act, and he was like, dog, you talk a lot, but I'm not really sure if you ever going to get back to the thing that you thought that you was, or the thing that you said that you was going to do that was supposed to be much greater than where you were, and you going further down the hole. You losing, big dog. And he said it way, way more harsh than that, and it bothered me to my soul. It absolutely bothered me to my soul. I couldn't even sleep. I was so mad at myself, not him, thankful to him, but mad at myself. But I was willing to hear it from somebody that was supposed to be my junior, and it absolutely gave me that dog. It helped me to remember who I was, what my goals were, and that I don't care who's in the office, what the president is, what the current economic situation is, I'm going to do everything possible to win at the highest level in every area of my life. And now it's reflected so many years later. What was it, 16 years later? 16 years later, here we are. And I the sky is the limit. Like, it literally uncapped, and it just took the lid off the ceiling, and we rolling. But the first thing that I had to do was realize that he was telling me what I needed and the truth so that I can make adjustments to ultimately get the best results. I don't think that women have that in them, or maybe it's just black women. I'm not sure. But even black women are telling you on the stream, hey, listen, this is y'all kryptonite. Y'all don't want to hear it. Y'all don't want to make the adjustments. And this is the reason why y'all losing. Let me know what y'all think in the comments. Make sure y'all tap into the Patreon again. I love y'all. I appreciate y'all. I'm going to holler at y'all later.
All right, here we go. They have it. As far as Quinn is concerned, based on how this brother rolled with it, I think the as far as the Swizzle, not one who hear people. I think the brother don't want to hear it either. But nevertheless, let's keep it moving. I want to deal with this question that I have on my paper, because they always. Not only do I post this stuff on the blog talk that I'm going to discuss, and you'll see it rolled up. I got from 1 to 10, but I also have a sheet of paper over here that I have notes on this stuff that I can refer to and check off that I've actually discussed to make sure I deliver as much relative content as I can possibly do. and I'm checking it off. And but before we get to other brothers losing interest in the sisters, let me talk about my personal, and this is my position as far as dating outside of my race. Me personally, I don't do that. Homie don't play that. You know, I'm not going to do that. Blackbirds, bluebirds. You know, I ain't got it confused. You know, I'm like Farrakhan asked the brothers one time before he started dating a white woman, said, "What do you need her for?" And nobody answered. He didn't have to ask me that because I was not part of that particular group of pigeons that he was talking to. Nevertheless, our psychology versus other people's psychology. Think about it for a minute. Okay, sisters? I'm going to start with you. We'll deal with the brothers in a minute. I'm going to start with you. If you were born with fingernails, that means you don't need to buy no more. If you were born with eyelashes, you ain't got to buy no more. This is seems to be the latest thing. Is I go into different stores and stuff, and I see the sisters walking around with all these long eyelashes on. Brothers don't care nothing about your eyelashes. It is amazing. You were born with breasts, which you went in Baltimore. You were born with hair, beautiful hair. And you know, all you have to do is take care of it. You take care of what you got it up. If you don't take care, you cut it low, grow it back, and as long as it's yours, but you went in Baltimore. You had toenails, you went in Baltimore. I don't like how my breasts look, and I don't like how my butt looks, so you went in Baltimore. But you're looking for a real man. Nevertheless, I'm going to go over here to other brothers losing interest in the system. Okay, let's go over there. Y'all got my position on my take on it. Well, let's go over here and take a look at this right here and see what we got. Okay, hold on.
I'm trying to be as simple as I can, but I don't know. I've been paying attention to like certain things lately, and I've noticed from what it looks like to me. And black women, please tap in if you are in agreement with it. If you're not in agreement with it, I want to hear your opinions. It seems like black men are no longer interested in black women to me.
Accusations!
These are not accusations. This is false accusation.
And
false accusation.
Why? I mean, how could black men of value not be attracted to the modern black female?
I utterly cannot take the men of this generation. You men are utterly distasteful and disgusting. Okay.
Do you know what today is? It's my child support day. Hey, I got a check.
A big red flag when dating is a man who carries feminine energy, such as wanting to be chased. That is a woman's quality. Real men carry masculine energy and are natural born hunters and don't have a problem with reminding you that you are the prize.
Why are black women constantly being told we need to lower our standards to find a partner? I rarely see anyone telling the white and Asian girls that their standards are too high to find a man. But yet black women are expected to accept struggle love and be ready to build with their partners.
White and Asian girls that their standards are too high to find a man.
Meanwhile, 63% of Asian adults in the United States were married in 2019. Asian women also have the highest rate of first marriages, with 67.3 per 1,000 in 2010, compared to 22.1 per 1,000 for black women.
I am so perplexed. When did men unanimously stop desiring 304 culture and post-war city girls for hire?
You can't run me off that easy now. I guess we got to shred it. We shredding these. You know what I'm saying?
Now, I'm not saying we're supposed to care about men taking us serious, but at the rate we're going, babe, that we're going to take us serious. Like, all the music that's being dropped by women is F My Baby Daddy, it's 7 p.m. Friday, it's Naughty by the Reeves. Like,
Yeah, glow. Like, it's like, I think that we're scaring the men to the point where some of them are taking vows of celibacy, and quite frankly, I understand.
What type of bizarro world are we living in? So I guess now you're going to tell me that you no longer desire the sweet demands of the formidable gold digger. You no longer desire the way she caresses your wallet.
If you're scared to ask your man for money, you are with the wrong person, okay? If you are scared that he's going to say no or not give you any money, why are you with him? Why are you with him? Having access to you should be the greatest privilege to him. If he doesn't see you as worth helping you out with your bills, paying for things, trying to impress you, why are you with that man? Why are you giving him access to your body if he's not giving you access to his wallet? Make that make sense.
Come now, don't you dare gaslight Lord Destro. It's clear that we all love RuPaul makeup trends and the cool breeze of inch-long eyelashes.
Sir, a man's job is to provide and protect for his woman. It is his job to provide, making sure she looks good, provide her outfits to make her look good. That's a man's job. Provide and protect.
Statistics show that only 26% of black women will marry in their lifetime from any race. 26% of black women will marry in their lifetime. My question is, why do you guys think that is? Why do we have such low marital rates? And I'm not talking about black women marrying black.
They're scared.
Men of all race wanting or desiring to marry a black woman. Why are we so undesired when it comes to marriage?
Well, one thing we're not going to do is hold black women accountable. I mean, there's got to be something or someone we can blame for black women's bad decisions. I know who.
Computer.
Yes, but of course, AI and the evil algorithm are the ones lowering the desirability of the modern black woman.
Not all milkshakes.
And I was like, what?
Are bringing quality boys to the yard. Outrage on TikTok.
Hinge is not for black women.
Very loudly not choosing us.
Black women calling out the dating app Hinge for putting their profiles at the bottom of the dating pool. It led some of them to change their settings as white women in the app.
Yeah, I'm staring at you. How?
Is there a problem?
Not really. I'm saddled over there with your black man accessory, and I'm just tired of that story, to be honest. It's basic. But that's just me, personally.
So all of a sudden, you men don't like giving up 300% of your salary as allowance to your woman. I sense you are not being candid with your grace. Fool me once.
Just fool me once. Shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
How much money does he have to make per year?
At least $100,000.
Going to 50-50 or someone who fully provides?
Fully provides.
What does that mean to you?
That I would have an allowance.
How much would that look like for you?
I would say like $7,000,
$5,000. A month? Or a year?
A month.
He needs $5,000 to $7,000
a month.
Yes.
Wait a minute, but she said the guy has to make at least $100,000 a year.
Yes.
Well, if he's only making $100,000 a year, and he has to give you $7,000 to $5,000 a month. Now, I ain't no goddamn math major, but he ain't gonna have shit left over to do.
If she is not desired, it's not a problem with her. It's a problem with us. But just for fun, let's hear what the other side has to say about this phenomenon.
So the ruling is in. Here's the three top reasons why black women have the lowest marital rates. We are uncooperative. We do not listen. And we have the nastiest attitudes. And unfortunately, y'all, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly, 100%. But it's the reality of where we as black women are. That we have created this narrative based on our actions, our behavior, to be these unruly women. I know we don't control who proposes, you know, who pops the question, but you have control over if it happens based on your actions. Don't forget it.
It's clear the high-value black man is carving himself out from the low-level bottom feeders. New standards are being established on what will be tolerated. Modern black women will only have two choices, whether to get down or lay down. Simple.
I've been with him since he was doing community theater. I cooked, I cleaned, I've had his back from the very beginning. I've always supported him. Maybe two good people found each other, and I'm a good woman who found a good man.
We can also see a sense of indifference in the modern man, no longer eager to fix the modern woman. They are more concerned with identification and immediate ostracism of these streetwalkers and succubus. But wait a minute. You didn't smash the bell and press the like button. Blast. And although you will never be worthy of a monarch such as myself, Lord Destro would suggest that you poor fools at least give Oligarchy a try.
All right, here we go. Let's go down here and let's look at this from a psychological standpoint. What are the what is the laws of psychology? Let's go.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Top Think. Today we're going to learn about 16 laws of psychological power. Now, let's begin. Number 1, stand above. Good work goes unrecognized. If you want to gain power, a good work ethic is not enough. Putting in long hours can easily be overlooked. The people who find power and success are the people who work hard and get recognized. If you don't stand out, you'll blend into the background. Your work will be overshadowed and forgotten no matter how excellent you are. So take every opportunity to lead and prove yourself. If you stand out, you can achieve your goals ahead of the rest. Number 2, hide your intentions. Imagine you're buying a new car. At the dealership, a car salesman shows you a model that you absolutely love. You tell the salesman how eager you are to own this car. The salesman knows your intentions, so he raises the price. Why? Because you gave him the power in the conversation. That's why it's so important to hide your intentions. All right, let's go back to our example. You love the car, but this time you act like you just don't care. Now you have the power. The salesman has to convince you to buy from him. Most of the time, salesmen will drive down the price just to win you over. So if you want to gain psychological power, hide your intentions. Hold the power in every exchange. Make the final decision because you want to stay in control. Give someone just enough details to stay interested, but keep your true intentions to yourself. Number 3, actions over arguments. You can argue as long and as hard as you want. You can take home the moral victory, but winning an argument achieves almost nothing. To gain psychological power, don't waste your time arguing. If someone wants to argue, let them. If they get defensive, let them nurse their own ego. But you know that actions speak louder than words. Your behavior will win over more people than a good argument ever will. Number 4, mind your words. The more you speak, the less valuable your speech becomes. This is one of the most important laws of psychological power. If you speak only when necessary, you increase the power of your words. People will learn to listen to you, they'll learn to take you seriously, and you'll earn their undying respect. So if you speak less, you also stop yourself from making clumsy mistakes. Many people run their mouths and then back themselves into a corner. They leak details or make promises they can't actually keep. So if you're mindful of what you say, you avoid these pointless mistakes. You ensure that every word is intentional and purposeful, and that gives you psychological power. Number 5, cultivate confidence. Your path will be littered with obstacles, failures, and setbacks. Your luck will run out, people will tell you to quit, and your own brain will stand in your own way. But the people who give up deprive themselves of psychological power. So if you want to improve, cultivate confidence in your life. Let your small successes empower your self-worth. Let each victory give you the courage to overcome your next obstacle. psychological power isn't just your relationship with others, it's also how you treat and motivate yourself. Number 6, hire your enemies. Friends are dangerous on your path toward success. We turn a blind eye to our friends. We overlook their mistakes and put too much trust in their decisions. Just when you think you trust someone, they stab you in the back and your career begins to suffer. Instead of getting blindsided by people you trust, earn the loyalty of people that you don't. You may not like your enemies, but hiring someone you don't trust gives you a clear-headed objectivity. Your enemies will also show you more loyalty because they have something to prove. Friends are an important part of your life, but friends can steal your power in a heartbeat. Number 7, people are selfish. If you need a favor, don't expect people to be selfless. People are more likely to help when they have something to gain. If they don't get as much as they give, then you're out of luck. Anytime you ask for a favor, don't waste your time with kindness or gratitude. Appeal to their self-interest. Explain how they'll be rewarded. Convince them that helping you will solve their problem. Make sure they know exactly how they're going to benefit in the future. If someone thinks they're helping themselves, they're much more likely to do you a favor. Number 8, avoid commitment. Avoid unnecessary promises. Commitments get people in trouble. They lock you into one side. They trap you in a box. If your team goes down, you'll go down with them. That's why powerful people avoid commitments. They stay open to multiple sides, angles, and perspectives. They keep one foot in every camp so they can make the most out of every situation. Powerful people always stay on top because they're only committed to one person, themselves. Number 9, play yourself down. Everyone wants to feel intelligent. If you want to win people over, make sure they feel smart. Sometimes that means you have to play dumb. But you already know you're intelligent. The fact that you can play dumb means that you have nothing to prove. To put it simply, most people don't care how intelligent you are. All they care about is their own brain power. So play into their hands. Make them feel smart. Give them confidence in their own ideas. You'll only make enemies by proving your intelligence. Number 10, support your superiors. If you want to climb the ladder, you have to respect the ladder. Don't try to outshine the people above you. These people will be stepping stones on your road to success. You need their help, so don't turn your superiors against you. Support your boss. Be their right-hand man, not their rival. When the next great opportunity comes, your superiors will recognize and recommend their allies, not their enemies. Now, sometimes this means making your bosses feel smarter than they are. Sometimes this means giving them too much credit for something you really did. But if you want to be successful, never forget to support your superiors. Number 11, stay concentrated. To find psychological power, don't just identify your strengths, develop them. Many people can do many things at an average level, but they're so busy jumping from skill to skill that they rarely specialize in anything. Specialties are one of the keys to success. If you concentrate on one strength, you can build a talent unlike anyone else's. And in the same way, if you want to build psychological power, don't spread yourself too thin. Concentrate on one direction, one project, or one purpose. Invest yourself wholly in that one direction. It's a bigger risk, but with enough dedication, your reward will be exponentially greater. Number 12, effortless achievement. What do you say after finishing a huge project? Do you tell people how hard you worked, or do you say, it was no problem? To gain psychological power, play down your achievements. Make each accomplishment seem easy and natural, because people will believe you. Even if you invested countless hours into your work, show the world someone who's confident and collected. You should never forget how hard you worked, but the world doesn't need to know. Number 13. The giant shadow. Are you succeeding a legend? Do you have gigantic shoes to fill? This is a big problem. On the surface, filling a large void seems like a fantastic opportunity. However, if your predecessor did amazing things, you have your work cut out for you. To get the same level of recognition, you have to surpass the person who came before you. Depending on the job, that may be almost impossible. So don't fill the shoes of a legend. Instead, be the person who brings your team back from the brink. Fill the void of someone who failed, and your success will shine twice as brightly. Number 14, set anger aside. Do you lose your temper? Anger is a destructive emotion on your road toward success. Anger makes you impulsive, narrow-minded, and selfish. If someone makes you angry, they know they've gotten the best of you. They know they've hit a nerve, so they'll keep pushing. Instead of getting angry, grow distant. Ambivalence is a far greater punishment than anger. When you ignore someone, you steal their power. You force them to get your attention. You make them do the work. Strong emotions will hurt your decision-making and help others take advantage of you. So keep your frustrations to yourself, stay calm, and stay objective whenever possible. Number 15, the calm rush. Time is a common source of psychological power. The most powerful people are masters of timing and time management. Not only do they pack incredible amounts of work into their daily schedules, they never let their busy days get the best of them, at least not on the outside. They always seem cool, calm, and collected. They're never rushing or sweating. They're always patient with their work and their goals. Because rushing is a recipe for disaster. It creates anxiety and it hurts your reputation. Instead of letting time control you, stay in control of your time. Your psychological power depends on it. Number 16, calculated value. They say the best things in life are free, but if you want psychological power, you'll need to spend money when it counts. Some things are worth paying for, even if it's just a name or a title. The effect of that name or title is worth all the money in the world. It's okay to be cheap and cost-effective in your personal life. However, if you want to climb the ladder, you cannot cut corners. Hey, thank you for watching Top Think, and be sure to subscribe because more incredible content is on the way.
All right, everybody, we're back. Now, let us take a look and see is white men in love with his Muslim? What evidence do we have of that? And I had a situation one time where I was dating a sister, and she was working on this job, and she kept coming home, and she told me, and every time I would have been here. But every time we knock off from work, because I'm one of the, I am the best employee in the whole place, and the guy that owns the sandwich shop, he would want me to stay and talk to him and sit down, and he want me to have a beer with him. I said, I don't do that. And he said, I know he probably trying to go to bed with me, but I had already told him that. And I said, yeah. I said, but if you have a beer, if you start drinking with him, then he going to call you the N-word. He going to do that. And, of course, I know she loved to have a beer, but I told her, I said, don't do that. I said, if you're doing that, stop doing that, because sooner or later, he going to call you the N-word. And so one day she came home. She said, you know what? You were right. And that sucker, he gave me one of these little shout Budweiser. He say, go ahead and, because I'm going, he said, I'm going to, the work that you be doing, I'm going to go ahead and do some of that right now. And then you get through with your beer, you come on and finish on up. And sure enough, he come in and start talking about it. How good I look to him and all that. And I told him, I said, hey, man, no, you know, I got a man. And so on, he got mad with me and called me the N-word. I said, didn't I tell you that he's going to do that every single time? In any relationship that he's in with you, sooner or later, one day, he's going to do that. But let's see. About a white man being in love with his Muslim.
Force them out of their bed and place them under arrest. Their crime, interracial marriage.
Love. Many say it is the one thing that makes the world go round. It is beautiful, it is kind, it is imperfectly perfect. But what happens if a man loves a woman whose race is different from his race, and the society and time makes things difficult for them to be? Watch this video to learn about the famous white men in Hollywood who fell in love with black women, and how in some relationships, they ended up in jail. It may seem like a normal thing to see a white man falling in love with a black woman nowadays, but fast rewind to early, mid, and even sometime in the late 1900s, it was not only weird, it was considered morally wrong. Errol Flynn and Eartha Kitt. In the 1930s and in the 1940s, Errol Flynn was a key figure in the entertainment business doing some swashbuckling films. Errol Flynn was indeed an adventurous man on camera, and when the curtains drew down, he was equally adventurous, especially when it came to romance. In the mid-20th century, Errol Flynn was struck by the beauty of the celebrated singer Eartha Kitt. Her elegant voice would tickle the ears of Errol Flynn, and just like that, a romantic relationship was formed. According to reports, this relationship would occur somewhere early in the 1950s. The couple's relationship was not the kind of relationship which would last for long. It was a brief thing. But as much as this interracial love was brief, it was very much intense. It was so intense that Eartha Kitt would recall the relationship between her and Errol Flynn, and all she could say was that Errol Flynn was a passionate and exciting lover. Eartha Kitt would even say that she had shared a very strong bond and chemistry with Errol Flynn, and every detail of their relationship was shaped to perfection. One thing worth to note is that in the 1950s, interracial relationships were seen as if they were not only unnatural and wrong, but in many states in the United States, would term interracial relationships to be illegal. The couple might have been in Hollywood, and they were celebrities with big names on them, but such kind of a relationship, especially for established celebrities like Errol Flynn and Eartha Kitt, would spark a significant backlash, and given the racial norms that were there at the time, it was destined to draw both fascination and scandal. It was not just the law that was a big issue here, there was the society, and the society was not taking it easy for Errol Flynn and Eartha Kitt. Eartha Kitt was actually the one who would face more challenges in the relationship. This was mainly because she was an African-American woman dating a white man in a white-dominated industry. This relationship would prove to be very dangerous to Eartha Kitt when it came to her career, and her reputation was also at risk. Her lover, Errol Flynn, was known to be a very controversial man. This would mean that it was more risky for Eartha Kitt than it was for Errol Flynn, but Errol would only add this relationship to his status of a controversial lifestyle. Eartha Kitt would reminisce the story, saying, "Errol was very charming and very wild. He had this devilish charisma that made him utterly captivating. Our time together was exciting and full of energy, but also fraught with challenges because of the racial attitudes of the time. Being with Errol was an adventure, but it was also clear to both of us that society was not ready to accept a relationship like ours. The scrutiny and the judgment were constant companions." Marlon Brando and Dorothy Dandridge. Marlon Brando was a man who was known for his high-profile acting and high-profile women. He did play amazing roles in films such as The Godfather, A Streetcar Named Desire, and On the Waterfront. As a man, Marlon Brando was very rebellious in nature. His rebellious nature would reflect his acting style and his personal lifestyle, to the extent that he was always defying societal norms at that time. He would fall in love with a woman who was known for the star role in the film that was titled Carmen Jones. This was none other than Dorothy Dandridge. Dorothy Dandridge was a woman who would break the racial barriers in Hollywood with her charming beauty. She was even nominated for an Academy Award for her role in Carmen Jones, and many would even say she might have won the award if it was not for unfairness. Just like Errol Flynn and Eartha Kitt, the relationship between Marlon Brando and Dorothy Dandridge would take place in the 1950s. The couple were deeply connected to each other, as they were both deeply attracted to each other. They shared a deep chemistry, and they were all trailblazers in what they used to do. They were just the perfect match at that time. It was through the shared experiences that the couple had in the entertainment industry that led to the deep connection between the two. Marlon Brando and Dorothy Dandridge both knew very well the intensity of the racial barriers that were surrounding interracial relationships during the 1950s. But despite all the things that were going on at that time, they just continued with their relationship with all the hostilities involved and all the disapproval they faced along the way. Despite all the societal norms that existed, the legal implications that the relationship could face, and the career challenges that they were being faced with their relationship, they would still get it on, and they had to navigate the harsh racial climate to fight for their love. But the couple were a bit smart. They did not take their relationship to the media. Everything they did, they would keep it away from the mainstream media, because they were fully aware of the amount of backlash they would face. Dorothy Dandridge would reflect on the entire situation of her relationship with Marlon Brando and the societal challenges, saying, "Marlon understood me in a way that few men ever did. He respected my talent and my struggles as a black woman in Hollywood. Being with Marlon was a breath of fresh air. He didn't see color. He saw me, Dorothy, the woman, and the actress. Our relationship was a beautiful escape from the harsh realities of the world we lived in. But it was also a reminder of how far society still had to go in accepting interracial love." On the other hand, Marlon Brando did have something to say on racial equity and societal prejudices, saying, "If there's anything unsettling to the stomach, it's watching actors on television talk about their personal lives. I don't think of people as colored. It's not my way of thinking. The only reason for race discrimination has been economic advantage. In Hollywood, we are all pawns of a capitalist system where only the color green matters." Richard Loving and Mildred Jeter. We cannot talk about what...
Okay, there you have it. Now, I still find it quite interesting because, remember, I told you, blackbirds belong with blackbirds. Bluebirds belong with bluebirds. Redbirds belong with redbirds. Squirrels are with squirrels. Elephants are with elephants. Horses are with horses, and the list goes on and on. There is a reason for that. But in this society where man is, he wants you to think, well, you know, first of all, let's go over here. And let's see what a brother has to say about interracial dating. Now let's see, because I don't want you to think that I'm blaming white folks for this, that, and the other. Let's try to cover the whole gambit from every conceivable angle, because either way it goes, there was a reason for nature to be the way it is, and there was a reason for us to be the way we are, but we seem to think that we can improve on something that's already in order. But in my personal opinion, you don't fix the wagon if it don't need fixing. That's just my personal opinion on this thing. But let me go down here, and I'm going to find this brother here and see what he has to say about interracial dating. What's his take on this situation? Let me go down here and find him. Y'all just hold on a minute. We'll get to him. Just a second. I got him right here. What I did with him. Where he at? This is amazing. I am right here. Okay, well, let me go over here. Let's see if I can find him over here. The head right here. Oh, wait a minute. I know it. I'm looking for the wrong word. Where is his word? Oh, here he is.
What I can see from the data is
80%+ of people are date inside their group.
Mm.
Me personally, I've dated everything. I say make yourself the best version of yourself and pick from the best you have available. Mm. Because at the end of the day, we're all human, but most people want their group.
Right.
See, what I think the disconnect comes when you feel like you're having to pick from lesser options, but that's a function of you.
Mm.
Like I said, if you make yourself the top choice or become the best version of you, and you can say and know not what you want, but know what you need, that's a difference.
Mm.
Know what you need and then pick for that and outcomes, not for short term. That's relationship. I mean, think about you and your best friend. Y'all want to kill each other sometimes.
Yeah, this guy want to kill each other all the time. Yeah.
But let somebody fuck with him.
Oh, yeah.
You know I'm coming.
That's it.
Blame me.
That's it. And that's the thing. We have that as men. Men want that with women, too.
Thanks.
And women want that with men. And the thing is, that person may look different from a want standpoint versus a need. And I just actually speak to that.
Mm.
And if you look at what it did with the thing with Tommy Lee came on, and she said, you know, I really do want that. I'm like, I just want to trust. I'm like, I get it. And more women would be likely to get what they need if they are willing to be vulnerable and risk saying that. Because what they've been told is every man out here ain't shit. Ain't nothing going on but the rent, bills, such and so forth. And women today, in my opinion, don't truly know modern men. They know the caricature. They know the character of men. I'm like, well, I mean, the icon of men. Now, what you need to do is understand, if you actually understood that they've got wants, needs, and desires too, it will be a lot easier for you to let your guard down and let yourself risk being in a relationship, because it's always a risk.
Mm. I saw a video of you discussing this sort of Instagram live that Tommy Loren did. And for those who don't know, Tommy Loren, kind of a conservative commentator and whatnot. And I had heard about the video because I was vaguely aware of it when it went viral. In the early days, basically a bunch of people dunking on her and try to act like what she was saying was crazy. Mm-hmm. I actually watched the video in the context of you sort of reviewing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, what she was saying was unbelievably commonplace, mm-hmm. obvious shit. She was basically saying, if you're a guy and you want to be with me or any of my friends who apparently also have good things going on mm-hmm. for them who are accomplishing something, don't do this, this, and this, because these are things that are going to make me not take you seriously. And as a person who's now in a relationship, I'm listening to her talk. I'm like, of course, if I was a guy and I wanted to mm-hmm. win over this girl, you're going to not want to do anything disrespectful to her. You're going to not make it obvious that you're just trying to hang out with her at 2 o'clock in the morning because you just got home from the bar, et cetera. And somehow... Sorry, I thought you were going for that. Somehow, this is considered controversial, and I'm watching you sort of like explaining that essentially this is pretty standard good advice if you want to be successful in your love life.
Yeah, and see, we have made this so damn complicated.
And somehow this is political as well.
It's complicated. I mean, we've overcomplicated it. And see, one of the beauties of my show is I acknowledge men are visual and women want... I'm all about hypergamy. Yes, you want the high value man. You want a man who can protect, provide, and whatever that comes in. But that's what you want. That's nature. I accept that. And men are visual. We have over freaking complicated. So I go back to something I said a little while ago by my Facebook group.
Mm.
You know what's unique about that? I just picked from men from. I just asked some basic questions. How old are you? Your marital status? Do you want to be married? Do you have any kids? And then I just went and verified, where you work. I don't care where you work, but just that's it. And from women, I pick women who are feminine, beautiful, and reasonable. That's it. I'm not a matchmaker. I'm not a love demigod, but I truly believe in human nature because image is human nature. I took men and women who were like-minded, and I did something novel.
Mm.
I put them in the room together.
Right.
And I said, here's what we're going to do. All the stuff that's outside, we're not going to bring any of the salacious, stuff that's just going to be openly controversial. We're not going to talk about that. This is a group for men. We get in here, work, network together, talk about business, da-da-da-da-da-da, and the women are our welcome guests. Guess what? Women get a chance to sit back and see me, you, and us to work together, talk, communicate. They come in and ask questions. I was like, you got to be able to be willing to answer questions because this is a different kind of woman. She's already admitted she's feminine, this, and she wants to be cooperative and work with a man. Guess what? Couples are getting together left and right now.
Mm.
I'm like, you leave people alone, and we will sort ourselves out. It's called assortative mating.
Mm.
Stop. Just let people be. But we've tried to engineer relationships based upon these false standards or standards, I won't say, things that create a narrative that ultimately doesn't make either side very happy.
Mm.
And you leave people alone. What's really funny is when a woman says, you know what, I never would normally consider a guy like this, but he had already passed this basic litmus test.
Mm.
And I got a chance to see how he moved, and then I like that.
It's the opposite of Tinder. Like when I was on Tinder back in the day,
oh,
I remember really feeling like this doesn't make sense to me because I'm a guy who goes to the bar and tries to meet girls. I'm a guy who goes to the club and tries to meet girls. Somehow I'm sitting here looking at this app. It's got like potentially infinite women, and it makes me feel miserable swiping through looking at them one by one because of the overt choice embedded in it. And what you're talking about is like, let's put a couple dozen people or whatever in this group and actually see what happens if they try to take each other seriously.
And you're picking on straight appearance.
Mm.
That's seven seconds. That's a very small time frame. And I've actually helped guys write profiles. And honestly, I'm on these apps because I like to know what's going on. Tinder, which was one before Tinder?
Bumble.
Bumble's a big one. Or it used to be.
But Bumble has changed. They've taken away the weight and thing. They want body positivity as this.
Oh God!
Mm. But I said, okay, you want that? But are you going to take the height and income thing away from men?
Mm.
Of course, you know that didn't work. but I look, you know, Match.com, Plenty of Fish, and I'm like, I've witnessed these things. I've dated on these things before, and it reduces people down to swipe left, swipe right. But then, what's the success out of this?
Mm.
The success comes from just asking some baseline questions. You know what a Sadie Hawkins dance is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's
when
what...
When girls ask the guys.
We miss that these days, yeah.
And basically, that's what I did with Match.com. That's what I did on Facebook. I said, these guys are provider males. And you are women who want men. Sadie Hawkins.
Mm.
And I look up, and somebody's like, oh, yeah, inside the first week, I'm in Boston. She's Atlanta. I flew up there. I'm finding out they're in a relationship 30 days later. I'm finding out, you know, I was going to go move out of here and I'm going to go to the DR. I joined your group just because I said I would. Now I found my wife, my fiance, who's now my wife. I'm like, well, and the thing is, how can a guy who's an image consultant, who's now become a relationship guru of sorts, how can I do that? And all you folks who are in this business, that's really where I'm at now. Where are you matchmakers? Where are your results? Where are these people? Because as an image consultant, I want you to come in, I want to get you square, and not want you to go out and win.
Mm.
I don't want to keep you on the payroll for a lifetime. I'm a failure if that's it. If you need me to dress you for every dadgum thing, you know, different at a higher level. But you know, you see what I'm saying? You're supposed to get people to the where they can move on and do something else. But we have a relationship, industrial complex, as it were, that keeps people single, miserable, taking Prozac, Zoloft, drinking wine, and watching Netflix and chill movies.
Mm.
That doesn't benefit the end user, does it?
And you mentioned Japan earlier, and I remember one thing that I saw when I went to Japan was the realization, you know, the guy who's showing us around says, this is a building where you can go in and you can hire a woman to cuddle with you.
Yes.
Not a prostitute.
Yes.
You don't have sex with her, but you lay there and you hold her and you stare into her eyes. So they've actually managed to, you know, commercialize every part of the relationship so that if you're looking for an intimate connection, here's a $20 an hour. You can stare into her eyes.
Okay, guys, we want to thank you so, so much for getting us to 100,000 subscribers right here on the Clips channel. If you want to support, please click that subscribe button. We're trying to get to 200K. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, we're back now. this goes against the grain of everything that I've been taught. I've said it 100,000 times. I was taught by men. It was two men. Well, actually, it was three. Two of them, well, actually, all of them were rich. But anyway, they taught me who the prize was. I had a sister one time. She told me She said, well, look, I'm looking for a man. Now, this sister, every Sunday morning, she's up and she's going to church every Sunday morning. So she said, I need me a man. I said, well, look, don't you go to church every Sunday? She said, yes, I do. I said, are there any men in the church or is it just all women? She said, no, there's men in there. I said, well, all of them married. No, all of them are not married. But I want a man. And then she told me, she says, well, you know, the woman is the pride. I said, who told you that? My mama told me that. I said, your mama got a man? Well, no, my mama don't have a man. I said, okay. But anyway, what I would like to recommend is you go and look at the movie called The Taming of the Shrew by Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Go and take a look at that one again. That's an old one, but I want you to pay attention to something. Richard Burton, the first thing he did was he went and got his own castle. He got his own horses and chariots and wagons. He had his own everything got his own. Okay, now, so he said, well, the only thing missing now is go get me a girl. And he would go in town and he find Elizabeth. She was rebellious because this man had several daughters, and she was the first one to go. And according to their custom, well, you had to bring a dowry over here and bring this, that, and the other, and then you can get her. And then she came on and wanted to give him his butt to kiss and all this right here. And I'm like, well, you know, what you doing, man? I mean, you seem to have it mixed up about what the prize is. But anyway, let's go and look at light skin versus dark skin.
Being light skin in that sense, sometimes you feel like you don't necessarily have a home. I'm trying to be with my people, but then it's like, oh, well, you're not really black enough.
Within the justice system, we're typically penalized more harshly than light-skinned people just on average.
I'm just curious if you've ever been close to skin lightning, Legion.
Yeah.
You really? Almost did?
Yeah. I don't feel comfortable being labeled by my skin tone. If you agree, please step forward.
The reason I feel like I don't like being labeled is because I don't like when people say that light-skinned women are so, oh, you're submissive, you're this, because I know ultimately what they're trying to say when they say that. It's saying something and then also not saying something really harmful about darker-skinned women, mm-hmm. and it upsets me. Number one, don't put me in a box.
Right.
And then you put me in a box that also negatively impacts another group of women, and I don't like that.
My opinion around the whole colorism issue in general mm-hmm. is that we're black. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to be a light-skinned black woman. I am black. I am Sabrina. I'm a black woman, and I'm my own woman, and I don't associate with the stereotypical light-skinned woman and what they do and what they portray.
Right.
So I'd rather just be considered a black woman, just like a darker-skinned black woman as well.
Do you think in a sense like that, people can maybe think that you're saying, well, I don't see color?
So that is kind of my opinion, and it is mm-hmm. kind of like what white people say when they don't want to be racist, I don't see color. Mm-hmm. And my own family primarily are all dark-skinned.
Right.
So growing up, I didn't. I saw beautiful people.
Mm-hmm.
I saw my family.
Mm-hmm.
I saw my dark siblings, and that's just what it was.
Gotcha.
Until recently, the conversation has really come up to the point where I'm starting to ask them, like, what was your experience?
Mm-hmm.
And they, too, say that they didn't have a negative experience for real. I literally see black people.
Mm-hmm.
I see white people.
Mm-hmm.
I see Mexican people. And mm-hmm. that's what it is for me.
Can we have the disagreeer step forward?
Girl, I'm nervous.
Can I just say one thing to you first off? I've
yeah.
dated a couple of light-skinned girls. Ain't nobody said they were submissive. First off. The reason why I didn't step forward is because dark skin, like everybody's starting to find out, the science is starting to agree. Dark skin is where it started, baby. And the reason why I think that I'm okay with being called dark skin and why I love the fact that there are light skin is because we have to realize that all of these people came from this prototype. Like I look at these beautiful dark-skinned people over here. And I always love the darkest people because they have no pimples, no nothing. It's just pure perfection.
Beautiful skin.
And excuse me, you know, this is not an extremist view, but we all know that dark is dominant and light is recessive. And I don't think that it's a negative thing to be called dark. I think the media wants us to think that, but I don't think it's a negative thing to be called dark. We're the originals, so that's great.
I acknowledge that we should not have to have these divisions and these terms. One term that illustrates that to me is brown skin. You know, the black right. people who are kind of in the middle. How ridiculous does that sound when we're all variations
brown.
Of brown? You understand?
Right. Right.
However, I didn't step forward because I'm not offended by being called dark skin. I will say there is a dehumanization that does occur with this labeling, like for instance, on social media. A light skin, a dark skin, that drives me insane. Now, I just wanted to address just a couple things you said. Mm-hmm. First, I want to say I'm very glad that your family members have not felt the impact of colorism. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy to hear that. I wish that was the dominant reality mm-hmm. for dark-skinned
exactly.
girls. Unfortunately, it is not. We have to remember colorism is not just social, it's systemic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they haven't necessarily felt the way that dark skin is perceived mm-hmm. in society, that doesn't mean that they may not one day feel that. I hope
completely
not.
Completely understand.
Yeah.
And that one thing I think that adds to it, though, is how you're raised. My dark-skinned siblings are my step-siblings. So my mother is light-skinned. My mother never mentioned our color.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Whereas, like, some parents will, like, prep you for the conversation. It was just never a conversation.
Yeah. We all got prepped. Did you guys all get prepped?
So, yep. And so that's what I'm saying. Even when I plan on having kids, I date a dark-skinned man.
Yeah.
Potentially, I can have a dark-skinned child.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go around just prepping them for the worst. I want them to just know that they're black and they're beautiful, whatever tone they come out.
I have to say, honestly, we're all black and all lives matter are the same to me. In the sense that both statements are true, but neither do anything to address the issue at hand, so they're meaningless.
Right.
Yes, we're all black. However, some black people are further marginalized because they are dark-skinned. And I understand what you're saying about not wanting to beat your children down with the idea of oppression, but not talking about it is not going to make it go away. My mother was extremely affirming to me as a dark-skinned little girl because mm-hmm. she understood that if she didn't do it at home, when I get out into the world,
exactly.
you know,
right.
we ain't in Kansas no more.
Completely understand.
Yeah.
But it's also when I say we're all black, is like if we were to get pulled over tomorrow, I'm black to a white man, to a white cop. What my point is more so is that we are dividing ourselves with this conversation as well.
Mm.
And I don't want that for us. I want us to just be on the same page because that way we can move forward in life.
My immediate reaction was no, solely because, like, I am a light-skinned person, you know what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying? But then you kind of brought up how, like, what's tied to it are the stereotypes that come with being a
right.
light-skinned person or a dark-skinned person.
Right.
And those can be detrimental
yeah.
to a light-skinned person or a dark-skinned person.
Yeah, right. Personally.
Do you believe that those stereotypes are majority true, though?
Whether they're true or not is kind of irrelevant. The fact that they're detrimental to people, I think that's the problem itself.
So when I first heard the prompt, I think when I was younger and I was growing up, like, being dark skinned was something I would, like, try to run away from because of the negativity surrounding that term. But, like, as I grow up now and I'm, like, living in a time where I see, like, models like Anokia and, like,
mm-hmm.
all these people looking up
and
to
you flawless, girl. Don't
and
talk
and
about
and
them.
And
look at
them.
Where am I coming from?
And, like, being more confident in myself, I'm like, yeah, I'm dark skinned. What about it? I also like it because I think when it comes to the black community, we're not a monolith, so I think it
right.
is good to, like, display that we are a diverse group, even though we are pretty large. On the other side, I do see how people nitpick a bit too much and
mm-hmm.
pay, like, way too much attention to the details.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I'm like, no, I'm just black.
I'm really interested in this conversation.
All right. I just want to give you a little bit of that. And we wind it down to the last 11 minutes. I'm going to take a little quick break, and when we come back, I need to find out what's going on with them brothers out there in L.A., man. What's going on? There's a man, he wants to talk about that. So, hold on. All right, we back now. Let me see what this guy, he say he want to say something about the brothers out there in L.A. I'm going to see what he got to say. And I hope it's some good positive stuff.
Yep.
So let's see.
The older man is back with another relationship discussion. So today we want to talk about the massive division between the black man and the black woman. We are the only race of people where the division between the males and the females are so wide apart that it's starting to become a real problem for black people in the West. And hey, I don't know if this is some diabolical design by some overlord that has created this massive division over time. The problem is, we're here. We're here where the black family is at its lowest and the worst. We're here because the female, and yes, I just triggered some of you ladies, but hear me out. Please watch this entire video. Share it with your other female friends that are single or that are married. I'm hoping that the married ones will actually help the single ones. We're going to hear from one woman, and then I'm going to share some comments on that video so that you ladies can just get the perspective from the female department, okay? But that's it. I'm just going to feature women today. So with that said, let's get into it. But you know what I'm going to ask you first and foremost. Subscribe, and like the video coming in, because you know you're going to like it. If you saw my video yesterday, you'd understand why I'm joking like this. But the point is, hey, I don't want you to forget. I would love for you guys to like the video so the algorithm can start pushing it out to more and more people. Okay? Even if you don't subscribe, at least like the video. Cool? Deal? All right. And if you have a quick question, get me over on Instagram on Ask an Older Man. More importantly, if you want to book a session where you need me to help you with anything, whether it's money matters, relationship matters, contemplating divorce, you know, whatever the hell it is, any life advice, the older man got you. I will give you my best opinion based on my life experience and my critical thinking skills. All right. So with that said, let's hear what this beautiful black woman says. All right.
So I need to talk to y'all about something. I recently went to an event and there were about 1,000 people there. And of the couples that were there, about 95% of them were black men with non-black women. The person leading the event was a black man that was married to a white woman. I'd be lying if I said that seeing all of this at the same time was not triggering. This is pretty much what the dating scene looks like overall in LA. Here are four other observations that I picked up on since moving to LA. One, it's not equal. It's not like I'm seeing a bunch of black women dating outside their race. In fact, I'm barely seeing black women dating at all. Two, it's gotten so bad that at this point, whenever I do see a black man that's single, the first thing that I'm asking myself is, I wonder if he dates black women. Three, within the past couple months, I've had conversations with multiple black women that actually want to leave LA. Not because of the economy, not because they aren't flourishing in their careers, but simply because they feel like there's no love for them in LA. The fact that I know so many beautiful, talented, compassionate, evolved black women that are all feeling the same way makes no sense to me. And lastly, when you don't see yourself reflected in a space, you feel like you don't exist. As a black woman myself, I can tell you honestly, when it comes to the romantic space, I have never felt more invisible than I do living in LA.
Wow. I've been telling you guys from the Kevin Samuels days, black women are at the bottom of the dating pool. I got ridiculed. I was sent some nasty messages. Why? Because you can't tell black women anything. You can't. I have five black sisters. Okay? I grew up as the only son in between all of those black women. And I can tell you, they're not easy. I love them to death, but they're not easy. Okay? I don't understand the black woman's attitude. Therefore, and of course, most of you already know that I'm married 19 years now to a white woman, British white woman. And Listen, I'm not the guy that found somebody on the internet, etc. I sort of looked at what was available in my space, and I found the best pick. I didn't care about skin color. That's just me.
Okay. Well, we're rolling down to the last few minutes of this broadcast. And I want to, once again, let me reiterate on the thing. The question is now, does multiculturalism benefit the Moors? And I'm trying to see how that works. Because if we got the sisters who's going into the Asian-owned hair store, nail stores, and hair stores, and weave. And my question is, if the brothers are dating the sisters is doing this, and they are taking the money that the brothers are giving them, and they're giving it to the Asians, I can't see how it's benefiting. How is that? Because, see, the Asians came here bringing their culture. The Mediterranean people, they came in, bring their culture. The Japanese come here, they bring their culture. And you partake of everybody else's culture, and that's where you spend your money. So the answer to that question is, does multiculturalism benefit you? I have to say no, because I am not multicultural, period. And I even told the feds that I'm not multicultural. So don't even come to me about that. We all, no, we ain't all got. Anyway, that's my position on that. As far as does the multiculturalism benefit somebody else. Multiculturalism benefits the people who are participating in that culture. If the Mexicans are participating in Mexican culture, it benefits Mexicans. If the Chinese are participating in Chinese culture, that's their culture. The Italians have their culture. Everybody has their culture. So I'm trying to figure out what is it about us where we, just like the brother said earlier, where, I date what is available. Well, that's not me. You know, blackbird like blackbird. I don't care how many Chinese women you got. Go ahead, I'll pass on that right there. Just give me a sister. Anyway, every man has his own preference, too, right? Okay, so that's my preference. I'm not trying to beat you up about what you do and how you see it, and I ain't looking down on you about how you see it. That's your preference, okay? Your preference belongs to you, and that's just the way it is. I'm not multicultural. Hey, all right. Well, anyway, we have come down to the end of the broadcast, and I'm going to go ahead and close this thing on out, and we'll be coming back in the very near future with another podcast. And but right now, I want to close this one on out so that we can start making preparations for the next show. And I do hope that you all have gotten something out of this broadcast. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana Elbe, and until next time, y'all have a good day.